Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the April 27th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. By now, if nothing else, the American people have discovered more than they ever knew about how undemocratic and unrepresentative is the system to elect our presidents that the nation's founders put in place over two centuries ago in order to keep the masses of the people from having a direct say in deciding who will be their president. Sure, everyone was aware of the Electoral College, but I suspect not the degree to which political parties, which have made no mention whatsoever in the Constitution, have succeeded in privatizing the electoral process, leaving it to their respective state operations to determine how the numbers of delegates can be allocated regardless of the outcome at the polls. And just to make sure they have the candidate of the party establishment wants heading to the ballot, unquote, unquote, Democratic Party has appointed hundreds of so-called superdelegates, which include all current and former Democratic officials, among them some who have since become corporate lobbyists. And those superdelegates have been counted by the media as if the votes had already been cast. Let's call it for what it is, hypocrisy with a capital H. Some of the elected governments in our hemisphere have been having a rough time lately, but not so much as the people who put them in office. One of them, oil-rich Venezuela, home to what was once hailed as the Bolivarian Revolution, and its now deceased leader Hugo Chavez as Latin America's successor to Fidel Castro, has been in economic and political freefall for months, brought about by a government corruption, U.S.-backed opposition, and the fallen price of oil. How the Western left has responded to the Venezuelan situation is one of the subjects that will be explored when, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking once again to Venezuelan-born professor Pedro Lango Shurian from the University of San Francisco. So stay tuned for that. Until then, I'm going to focus on one of the most touchiest subjects when it comes to our electoral and political processes, speaking aloud about the significance of Jewish money and the influence of the pro-Israel lobby in deciding who wins and loses in our elections. Well, a number of books have been written about the lobby's influence for years from a variety of political perspectives. It's not one you're likely to hear mentioned or discussed on AM or FM radio for fear of being labeled anti-Semitic. That goes double when it comes to speaking about the money, despite the larger-than-life presence of billionaire Sheldon Adelson, already has held three auditions for Republican candidates at his Venetian hotel in Las Vegas, and on the Democratic side, Israeli-American media mogul Haim Saban, who has given already more than $30 million to both Clintons and their foundation. So it wasn't exactly a public discussion, however, 10 days ago, when on the first night of J Street's convention in Washington, D.C., there was an unusually open discussion about the extent of Jewish influence on our national elections. J Street, for those unaware of its existence, is a liberal pro-Israel Jewish lobbying organization in Washington, founded in 2007 with major funding from George Soros. It declares itself to be both pro-Israel and pro-peace, while positioning itself to the left, relatively speaking, of AIPAC, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which in recent years has moved away from its traditional nonpartisanship to embrace the Republican Party and the Netanyahu agenda. While supporting continuing unconditional U.S. military aid to Israel, J Street opposes Israel's settlement policy, supports a two-state resolution of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and supported the administration's nuclear deal with Iran, which was a minority position within the Jewish political establishment. According to its website, it, quote, supports a new direction for American policy in the Middle East, diplomatic solutions over military ones, multilateral over unilateral approaches to conflict resolution, and dialogue over confrontation with wider international support. On the evening of April 17th, J Street hosted a panel at a Washington synagogue entitled Pundits, Pollsters, and Politicos, among them NPR's Mara Pliason, and the head of the Pew Research, Alan Cooperman. New York Times columnist Roger Cohen was the moderator. When Cohen asked J.J. Goldberg of The Forward, editor-at-large of the New York Jewish Weekly, to explain the importance of funding to pro-Israel politics, Goldberg responded, "Funding?" Then he gave an uncomfortable little laugh and said, Up until recently, I was under the impression that the Democratic had to go to Jews. You ask a Democratic fundraiser, where do you get the money from? Well, from trial lawyers, from toys, from generic drugs, from Hollywood, from Jews. Those are all essentially Jewish industries, noted Goldberg. When you're raising money, you need to find rich people who are not right-wing, and there are not, pardon me for saying this, said Goldberg, there are not many rich goyim who are not right-wing. Forgive me for saying that, quote. For those not familiar with the term goyim, it's a largely deprecating Yiddish word for non-Jews, although it seems Goldberg meant that in a humorous way. Then Goldberg said he had just read something, quote, that knocked my socks off, end quote. And then he goes on to say the Center for Responsive Politics had issued a list of the top 50 donors to the 527 PACs and super PACs and discovered that 8 of the 36 Republican biggies were Jewish and 14, excuse me, out of the 14 top Democrats, only one was not Jewish. Goldberg's candor about the Jewish weight on the Democratic side apparently liberated the one person on the panel who wasn't Jewish. It was Stephanie Shirok, president of Emily's List, the well-known pro-choice group that has been working and funding pro-choice women candidates since 1985. When questioned by Roger Cohen, here's what she had to say.
You've advised a lot of politicians over the years on these issues, and tell us what it was like in the past when you were advising somebody beginning a campaign in terms of what had to be said or not said to win the Jewish vote, and how that's different today, if it is.
Well, as I've listened to all of these amazing comments and a lot of conversation about the Jewish vote, I think the main question that was asked to JJ was about the money. I think that is a big piece of this story and cannot be overlooked at all. I was thinking of some of the conversations I had over the summer with some of our federal candidates. I mean, Emily's List works with 50-plus federal candidates every year. Most of those federal candidates have been in the state legislature or haven't run before at all. They have not looked beyond their cities, let alone their state borders. Goodness gracious, there's another world out there beyond the United States. And they jump in to this really trying to change the economy and build jobs and, you know, help their communities. And this issue is very, very far, not just in the eyes of the voters, as we just heard, but in the eyes of so many of our candidates. And so when something like the Iran deal came up early in an election cycle where we already had candidates running who were not going to take a vote but were asked for position, there was a lot of angst over what to do and how to handle that. And these are folks who have not been briefed, do not have access to these briefings, do not have any of the information other than what they're reading in the newspaper. And it was a really trying time to help guide the candidates. And someone who's been doing this now for two decades, I realized that I had the freedom as an operative, as a strategist, to say to some of our candidates, which I in fact did, is do what you feel is right here. Because we...
As Bernie Sanders did the other night, presumably.
Exactly, because I think there is enough, there's enough energy around all of it now than there used to be. So if you decide to be against the deal, there's going to be folks that are going to be with you. If you're going to be for the deal, there's going to be folks that are going to be with you. Now, I say that is that was the first time I went, wow,
well, what
there's
about,
really
what about
a change.
If you, well,
because in the, I was going to say...
What about if you said... What about if you said, well, I want to say that I believe Israel should stop building settlements and get out of most of the West Bank. What advice? Would that be going too far?
I would send them straight to J Street. And by the way, I do, so thank you. And that is a significant difference here. So I started as a finance director. I worked for candidates in the 90s as their finance director, and I would come on a congressional race. I'm a 20-something kid who also knows nothing beyond the state borders, let alone overseas. and you thought about where you're going to go to raise the money that you needed to raise to win a race. And you went to labor, and you went to the choice community, and you went to the Jewish community. But before you went to the Jewish community, you had a conversation with the lead AIPAC person in your state, and they made it clear that you needed a paper on Israel. And so you called all of your friends who already had a paper on Israel that was designed by AIPAC, and we made that your paper. This was before there was a campaign manager or a policy director or field director, because you got to raise money before you do all that. I have written more Israel papers than you can imagine. I'm from Montana. I knew where Israel was until I looked at a map. And the poor campaign manager would come in, or the policy director, and I'd be like, here's your paper on Israel. This is our policy. We've sent it all over the country because this is how we've raised money. And so you asked, what does that mean? That means these candidates who, you know, were farmers or school teachers or businesswomen ended up having an Israel position without having any significant conversation.
But you're saying all Israel papers were the same. They were identical.
Very similar. Incredibly
similar. I mean, for a country of more than 300 million people with lots of different views on lots of different subjects, that's a pretty amazing cornering of the market, isn't it?
It's astounding. And when I look back at it, it's shocking.
And that was Stephanie Sherrock, head of Emily's List, speaking on a panel in Washington on April 17th. And though if you search hard, you'll find the entire panel discussion on YouTube, and it's worth watching, listening to. I suspect you will not hear what I just played for you on any other radio program. The panel took place 2 days after Bernie Sanders did something during a presidential debate, which Roger Cohn referenced, with Hillary Clinton in Brooklyn that had never been done before. He criticized a prime minister of the state of Israel, saying that Netanyahu was not always right and that we are going to have to treat the Palestinian people with respect and dignity, and that Israel used a disproportionate attack during its 50-day war in Gaza in 2014. Sanders also criticized Clinton's speech before AIPAC for not reflecting on the reality of the Palestinians. As mild as all that was, it represents a breakthrough. He received a huge round of applause for his comments at the debate in Brooklyn, and the sky did not fall down. Sanders did lose New York, and after last night's results, the chances of him gaining the Democratic Party nomination have become realistically non-existent. But he speaks to the young people of America who are no longer willing to buy into the party establishment lines put forth by Clinton and her backers, and particularly so when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, where Israel, in party parlance, could do no wrong. The cracks in that support were evident at the 2012 Democratic Convention, when after the platform committee had refused to include statements praising God and recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The frustrated chair of the committee attempted to get the convention delegates to overrule the committee's decision. It made for a moment of comedy, which I played for you at that time, but it sent shivers up and down the backs of the Democratic establishment. It's worth listening to again, since the party bigwigs have apparently stacked the platform committee this time with pro-Israel delegates to make sure there's no repeat performance in July when Philadelphia during the convention. So the first voice you hear will be that of Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles and a darling of the city's pro-Israel community, who was presiding over that part of the convention in 2012.
Recognizes the delegate from Ohio, the chair of the platform drafting committee, former governor Ted Strickland.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move that we suspend the rules to permit an amendment to the platform adopted by this convention last night.
Governor Strickland has made a motion on the floor to suspend the rules. Is there a second? A motion to suspend the rules to permit the amendment to the platform has been moved and seconded. This is a non-debatable motion requiring a two-thirds vote. All of those in favor of suspending the rules, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. In the opinion of the chair, there's been a two-thirds affirmative vote to suspend the rules. Governor, would you like to make your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This summer, I was proud to serve this party as the Platform Drafting Committee chair. As the chair, I come before you today to discuss two important matters related to our party's national platform. As an ordained United Methodist minister, I am here to attest and affirm that our faith and belief in God is central to the American story and informs the values we've expressed in our party's platform. In addition, President Obama recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and our party's platform should as well. Mr. Chairman, I have submitted my amendment in writing, and I believe it is being projected on the screen for the delegates to see. I move adoption of the amendment as submitted and shown to the delegates.
A motion has been made. Is there a second? Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the matter requires a two-thirds vote in the affirmative. All those delegates in favor say aye. All those delegates opposed say no. In the opinion of the... Let me do that again. All of those delegates in favor say aye. All those delegates opposed say no.
A silly grin comes across his face.
I guess... I'll do that one more time. All those delegates in favor say aye. All those delegates opposed say no. In the opinion of the chair, two-thirds have voted in the affirmative. The motion is adopted, and the platform has been amended as shown on the screen.
And that was 2012. It was clear watching the sound recording of that in each occasion the no votes slightly exceeded the yes votes, the no's against the ayes. Well, as I mentioned, the party establishment has packed this year's platform committee to make sure such a vote doesn't come to the floor in Philadelphia. We'll see. Finally, another story you're not likely to hear or read about. 83 senators, 51 Republicans, and 31 Democrats have signed a letter to President Obama to ask him to approve a larger defense aid package for Israel, something the president has already agreed to do. So it's just about these senators seeking 2016 campaign funding from Israel's well-heeled backers and nothing more. You're not going to read about it. But the letter initiated by Delaware Democrat Chris Coons and South Carolina Republican hawk Lindsey Graham stated, quote, "In light of Israel's dramatically rising defense challenges, we stand ready to support a substantially enhanced new long-term agreement to help provide Israel the resources it requires to defend itself and preserve its qualitative military edge," end quote. Israel currently receives $3.1 billion a year military aid from the U.S., While the letter did not suggest a specific figure, Israel wants between $4 and $4.5 billion annually as part of a new defense package for the next decade. Obama administration officials, meanwhile, have proposed a lower figure of $3.7 billion, but that's apparently not enough for our greedy allies. Presidential candidate Ted Cruz was among the letter's signatories, while Bernie Sanders was not, nor, as I have been told, were Barbara Boxer or Dianne Feinstein. Speaking to the Times of Israel last month, Graham, chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on State Foreign Operations and Related Programs, he vowed to, quote, "do everything I can to squeeze some money out of a tight budget to help increase funding for Israel," end quote. That's Lindsey Graham. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. This morning we feature two human rights giants from Palestine, each of whom has a long record of resistance to the Israeli occupation going back to their youth, which, of course, translates into being considered terrorists by the Israeli government. And as a result of that resistance, they have arrest, detention, and prison records, as do virtually all resistors to the occupation, which means obtaining visas to travel is very difficult and sometimes impossible. But this time they were able to get the necessary documents to come to the United States, and we are most fortunate to have them on This Week in Palestine. Raji Sorani lives in Gaza and is the founder and director of Palestine Center for Human Rights. Shawan Jabarin lives in Ramallah and is director of Al-Haq, the oldest and best-known human rights organization in the West Bank, and a member of the advisory committee of Human Rights Watch. The presentations you will hear this morning were recorded at an event at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. Here is Raji Sorani from Gaza, followed by Shawan Jabarin from Ramallah.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be in Boston, great to be at Harvard, and especially at the Kennedy School of Administration, and with all the new friends. I mean, we knew for a quite long period of time. 22 years ago, Oslo Accords were signed, and I'm not personally a big fan of it. But it intended to be A and B. A, confidence-building measure between the two parties, Israel and Palestine. Second, to conclude the Palestinian state in May 4th, 1999. So this was, I mean, the wish, and since then, we decided to work as a human rights activist in simple two agendas. A, to work on the occupation agenda as if Palestinian Authority doesn't exist, and due to simple fact that the occupation will continue in its legal, physical form for the transitional period. Second, we will work on Palestinian Authority, national authority, as if the occupation doesn't exist, awaring about the area of jurisdiction, the power it enjoyed, no sovereignty, but we wanted to seize unique opportunity for a state in a process and try to lay down paces, solid paces, for rule of law, democracy, and the human rights within the authority. So then when the Palestinian state comes, there will be the real paces, I mean, for that. We don't begin from scratch or zero level. Very unfortunately, shortly after that, that Rabin was assassinated, definitely not by a Palestinian. And after that, President Arafat was killed, and definitely not by a Palestinian. The fact that we are having, after 22 years, in Gaza and occupied territories at large, three major basic things. A, we are having in Gaza siege, illegal, inhuman, criminal, sort of persecution and crime against humanity, suffocated Gaza socially, economically, and otherwise. And Israel didn't satisfy with that. They launched, in 6 years only, three offensives. Not offensive against resistance groups, but civilians were in the eye of the storm, and civilian targets were the real victims. Maybe Gazans deserve that. They are supporting Hamas, and Hamas exists in Gaza. But what about Jerusalem and the West Bank? They have fantastic partners. Our president, President Abbas, they praised him, welcomed him, and they said he is fantastic and he can be a real partner of peace. But Jerusalem, subjugated to unprecedented level of ethnic cleansing for Palestinians, Muslims, Christians, Judaization, using all administrative, practical, legal ways, means, and the fait accompli policy, and imposing that, curtailing, enclaving East Jerusalem with quite a lot of settlements, which it changed not only the demographic structure, but the geographical structure of Jerusalem. West Bank, in simple words, we can say the settlements policy, expanding settlements, existing settlements, vertically, horizontally, new settlements, are built bypass roads connecting these settlements with Israel directly, with roads only used by settler Jews, and with roads enclaving Palestinian villages, camps, and cities, enabling them in no way to expand or having any leverage. It's vice versa. Incursions on daily basis to the Palestinian cities, villages, camps, killing, destroying, and arresting a lot of them, and we so far having 7,000 plus Palestinian prisoners, among them many parliamentarians, tens of parliamentarians who are subject to administrative detention. And all these prisoners systematically subjugated to torture, which is legal in Israel. Israel destroy houses, kill youngs, saying we do that legitimately as U.S. defending its citizen, or U.K. defending its citizen, or all civilized world defending their own citizens, forgetting one simple fact that we have criminal belligerent occupation lasting for the last 50 years almost. Next year it will be 50 years, half century. In simple words, what we are having in the West Bank, a new brand of apartheid. Our South African counterparts, when they come and visit, they say, we have the apartheid, this is not something we read in books. But yours are more savage, more brutal, more bloody. So we are talking about unique and the new brand of apartheid in 21st century. Gaza, due to the siege, paralyzed the social economical life. More than 65% unpaid or employed, 90% under poverty line, and 85% received their rations from UNRWA, World Food Program, other resources. So in simple words, this Gaza, which has one of the highest percent of university graduates on the world, and no illiteracy, and having very skilled working class, and having very strong business community, which has enough money, don't need any donors to pay one penny, suffocated completely and shifted to be a nation of beggars. This is the biggest man-made disaster. Now, last offensive in summer 2014, we are not the groups, human rights groups, defending resistance groups. Whether it's Fatah, Hamas, or Jihad, or PFLP, left or right, or religious, we are defending simply the Palestinian citizens, the Palestinian civilians, who are in the eye of the storm. But 7 years were not enough. I mean, for Israel to impose the closure, but more to launch a three war, and not to rebuild Gaza in two of them, and the third came in 2014, and they were doing the following. They targeted our twin towers in Gaza, the most beautiful high buildings, Al-Basha building, Zafar building, and the Italian building. Knocked them down to the earth. Same thing as had happened here, for no legitimate reason whatsoever. They erased entire areas. Shija'iyya, Beit Hanun, Izzanna, Khan Yunis, using what's called Dahya Doctrine and Hannibal Doctrine. 89 family has been deleted. Deleted because bombs with 985 kilos or 2 tons dropped on them. So Najjar family 29 vanished. Young, old children sitting at the Ramadan, at the time of iftar, just wanted to have their bread and vanished. Hello family, 17 members vanished. Batish family vanished. Maybe death was mercy for those. But those who left from the family are suffering more. No safe haven in Gaza. 365 square kilometers, 2 million people, the most dense populated area on earth, used all kinds of arms you can think of. F-16s, Apache, drones, gunboats, tanks, artillery, land-to-land missiles. No one in the 2 million, including myself, my family, thought next morning will come, he or she would be alive. None of us. 51 days ongoing, just in simple words like that. 570,000 people became displaced. Their houses has been destroyed. Different areas, whether in the north or east of Gaza, and they fled their places. They were threatened if they would stay, they would be killed. They were threatened not in words, not by messages, not by telephone, but the bombs and the killing and the destruction. The death coming from the sky was the message for them. The Israelis played on the psychology. They were asking 42% of the Gaza population to move from one area to another. And when they were moving, the areas they moved to, suggested by Israel, is bombed again. UNRWA helped these people in having their schools as shelters. And even these shelters were subject to bombing. Whether they are sleeping day, night. And you will find tens of women, children, elderly, parts and pieces. even with UNRWA giving the GPS locations of all these schools more than one time. It really hit them with no mercy. Hospitals, even operation theaters, were not exception on the rule. Ambulances with nurses, doctors, and injured people targeted and killed. Even at the time of ceasefire, when people thought they can have some breath, like the poor Bakr family and went to the beach, the four children, in front of the journalist who wanted to catch their breath and having a meal on the nice area of Gaza on the beach, they saw them, how they killed them like birds with no mercy. They knew them, they knew they were playing soccer, and they bombed them. It's endless, you know, stories, and it's endless crimes we can go and talk about. This is carried by the most ethical army on earth. It's the Israeli army. The Attorney General, the military attorney general of Israel, Mag, gave before and during the war and after the war statements to the press. He said, no worries. All the basket of targets which has been designated by the Israeli army to hit has been approved by our legal advisors. And it's all legitimate. And he's the same one. We submit our complaints as a human rights organizations and lawyers represent victims for him to investigate and to hold accountable those who committed these war crimes. The only power station in Gaza has been targeted and bombed. Even sewage system, can you imagine this pose a threat on the strongest fourth army on the Middle East, in the world, and the strongest in the Middle East? And according to that, you know, our sewage just go and pollute completely the only place where people can think of having some oxygen. Now, we are romantic revolutionaries and we believe in rule of law, the human rights. We think this is not something only, you know, Harvard School of Law teaching or Columbia University. No, I mean, it's for the victims to have it on their skins. All the way long, we were warning. No contradiction between rule of law, democracy, and human rights, and peace and security. The American diplomats and the Europeans were having different ideas. No. We have to compromise rule of law, democracy, and the human rights for the sake of peace and security. This is the result. Organized, systematic war crimes against Palestinian civilians and civilian targets. The harvest is Israel feel just having the upper hand, free hand, no accountability, no criticism. They can get along with anything they want, even if these crimes, as it had happened, broadcasted live on air at the real time. And the whole world saw that. Israeli legal system provided all the way long full legal cover for these organized systematic crimes. And when we go even about Gaza siege, which the ICRC, the Red Cross, says this siege illegal, inhuman, consists collective punishment, and should be lifted completely and imminently, supported by all international human rights organizations, including the Israeli human rights organizations, the answer will come from the Israeli High Court of Justice and saying, nobody should be worried about famine in Gaza. We are monitoring the situation and we know how many calories each Gazan takes. Before anything happens, we will intervene. If this is not racism, what we call it? I'm not talking about crazy general or colonel, you know, who's doing war crimes. No. You are talking about Israeli High Court of Justice legitimizing the siege, legitimizing extrajudicial killing, legitimizing the termination of families, legitimizing all these horrible acts carried day after day. And when we decide to go and seek justice on the universal level, and we go and have universal jurisdiction cases in London against Doron Mog or Tzibi Livni, or when we go to Madrid and they give us court decisions out of the blue, you will say public. Foreign minister coming up after the court of law in respected European countries, not in Ouagadougou, in London and Madrid. Sorry, we apologize and we promise to change the law, and these decisions are not going to be implemented. So that means you are complicit, you are endorsing, you are partner, you are indulging the rule of jungle at that part of the world. You are giving legal cover once and again for criminals wanted according to the standards of your own countries. Then we say we have to resort to the ICC. Oh, what a crime we are doing. Then we are described as people who are doing lawfare, misusing law, misusing international law, and misusing the victims as well. We are trying to deform the image of this fantastic army and this fantastic state, which is the oasis of democracy in the Middle East. And we have to stop that, and pressure amounted not by groups here and there, but by states on the Israel, on the Palestinian Authority, not to sign or ratify Rome status. And when PA sign and we begin to engage and deal with, Shawa and Jabbarin have the threat of death and his staff. How dare you make submissions to the ICC? So direct threats, dead roses, etc. goes. Even mothers and fathers of lawyers working these cases, not that themselves, are threatened. Now, having said that, and having said that, as Sarah knows, for the last 35 years or so, legal documenting, or these were crimes and crimes against humanity, and putting it in first-class legal file in cooperation with some fantastic international lawyers who are helping us, I mean, doing this over the course of years. In the Israeli legal system, we achieve zero results. With universal jurisdiction, we achieve zero level results. And the facts on the ground are so ugly. So, should we give up? Should we stop doing that? Should we tell the Samoni family, Daya family, Batish family, when they come to our offices, well, listen, folks, in this world, there is no justice. There is the rule of jungle. We are lawyers. We are human rights activists. We believed in justice. We tried over the course of years, but this is the result. This world has no justice for you. And we think what's happening, this is the rule of jungle. And these are Bin Laden rules, these are ISIS rules, and this is the West rules. If you deal with a place like Gaza, and I'm just giving as example, siege with all these disastrous consequences, three wars in 6 years with all the level of death and destruction, if you disconnect people from the outside world, if you don't allow people to move in and out, to study, to work, to be treated, whatever, if this level of unemployment and poverty comes, if you lose hope in law, in justice, in tomorrow, is that what the Americans want? This is the environment, the idealistic environment for Bin Laden. Chapeau for Hamas, we don't have it. Yet, who can guarantee what might happen in the future? No one guarantee. But is that what the Americans want? Definitely, this is what Israel wants. They want more extremism. They want more militants. They want people to give up hope. They want the rule of jungle and people, you know, do anything, I mean, they can. And then they will have more excuses to attack, to kill, and destroy. But is that really, I mean, what's wanted? We think we have no right to give up. We want at that part of the world simply rule of law. We want at that part of the world for victims justice, dignity. If I cannot treat my water and my sewage, if even I cannot control this, what can I do more? So, in simple words, we will not give up, and we have no right to give up. We will not lose our strategical optimism as well. Hard times pushes either or, to give up or to stand for a challenge. We are standing for a challenge. We know we are defending just, fair, right cause. We know more. We know we are in the right side of history. And we know one day we shall overcome. We are the stones of the valley. We have been there since ever, and we will continue there forever. Thank you.
It's a great honor to be with you tonight, today. And I was in this city in 1990 when I received my award, Reebok Award. And at that time, the senator, John Kerry, he was here and in the ceremony, and he gave us the award. Today he is in his position. We met him at that time as a senator. Today, I think no one from the State Department want to meet with us. That's it's hard after to speak after Raji when he covered all of these things. But I would like to try my best. One, I would like to encourage you all to go and to visit and to see things directly on the ground. We are ready to take care of you if you come. We have a program to take officials, parliamentarians, civil society, academics, to show them the reality on the ground. And we are ready to take that for you too. Welcome anytime. I encourage you all really to come. Anything we will address to you, it will not be more than 1% of the reality on the ground. That's the case now in Palestine. Another thing is, I don't think any of us here or anyone else feels that can make a peace without justice. And I don't think there is any security also without justice. Justice is the cornerstone, you know, in any step you want to move forward. But Israel, I think they have one strategy only, is force and force and force. That's. It's clear. Even it's clear from the evidence on the ground, the policy, the practices, what they are carrying out every day. I ask myself many times, I put myself in their position and look at the situation. Really, this is what I do every day like that. When I look at them, you know, just demolishing houses of the families for punitive reasons, official policy. They kill the son of the family. They refuse to return the body. They keep the body weeks, months. Now still, there are bodies from Jerusalem more than 4 months in their hands, and they refused, and they make a deal. They make a deal with the families to give them back the bodies. One of the deal is not to make an autopsy. What's this? One of the deal is to bury them after midnight with 20 people maximum, 20 participants in the funeral maximum. And if they breach these conditions, or mainly the condition of burying after midnight with the 20, they have to pay around $6,500, 20,000 shekels. This is the fine. And in the same time, they come and they demolish their house and send them to the street as a homeless. What's security in this policy? When you send the people as a homeless, they have nothing to lose after they lost their son, their daughter, the house. I'm sure this is a very ideal environment to commit anything, to do anything. It's exactly against the security, 100%. What's, I used to address this question to myself. What they will gain exactly from all of these things? But at the end, I concluded with one answer. There is a long-term plan behind that. There is politics behind that. The long-term plan is to push Palestinians outside of their country. A message to all Palestinians to say that you have no future. You have no safe life in this area. If you want to have a future, you have to look for it outside. That's, maybe I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, let them just address this issue to tell me exactly what they will gain from all of these things. Some of them, they said, this is like a preventive measure or prevention, you know. And it works. Today, yesterday, I heard one of the Israeli military officers, he said it works. But I know that when the 15 years old, 16 years old, 20 years old want to do something, they don't take care and they don't take any things in their mind, the house, the family, things like that. They decide, they react. They are not making, let me say, just addressing questions like that to themselves. And they, Israeli themselves, long time ago, they said also, and they concluded, that this policy doesn't work. But today, they intensified this policy in Jerusalem. And why in Jerusalem? Because the policy is clear. They are taking, you know, different, you know, actions, different policies in the same place. One, administrative policy. Family unification, they push Palestinians, they separated between, you know, between the family members. They are targeting the family unity, mainly in Jerusalem, because they want to push the Palestinians outside of the city. They don't let them to build freely. When they apply for instance, for license, building license, they refused and they reject. And if they give them, it cost them more than $100,000 just for the license. It's a very, very expensive. This is the case in Jerusalem because they are targeting Jerusalem. That's the case. They try to make the life of Palestinians in Jerusalem impossible just to push them outside. Because of that, yes, they pushed them outside. Now, if you go between Ramallah and Jerusalem, there is a place called Kufr Aqab and Semiramis. In that area, officially that area, it's part of Jerusalem municipality border. But the Israeli, they close their eyes. And it's behind the wall. Just keep that in your mind. It's behind the wall. And now the Palestinians in Jerusalem, they feel that, okay, this part, it's part of the municipality. We will save and we will keep our ID with us, which called permanent residency with us. They don't deal with the Palestinians that this is their city. No, they deal with them as a residence. It's okay. And the element, the basis of the residence or residency status is the life center, you know, center of your life, where you stay. If you don't live there continuously and approve that by, for instance, taxes, by school certificates for your children, it means that you are not staying here and this is not your center. And here they revocate your residency. This is another way. And because of that, now many of the Palestinians, thousands, from inside the city, they left just to build outside. And the most poorest Palestinians, they are living in Jerusalem these days. The highest percentage of the young, you know, Palestinians, the young students, they left their schools, is in Jerusalem. They are targeting even children in Jerusalem. They separated them from their families. Now we have tens of them, just 12 years old, 10 years old. They are separated them and they send them to the other part of the city, let me say to the northern side. Just why? For security reasons, because they are throwing stones on settlers. Yeah, I'm speaking facts. What's going on, just to show that there is a policy behind. This is what gives the answer why they are demolishing houses, not for security reasons, for political reasons. Why they are targeting the family unity. And now tens of thousands of families in West Bank separated, West Bank and Gaza separated. That's since 67 until 91, 120,000 Palestinians, they lost their IDs. They left to study outside, they left to work outside, and they couldn't come back. Just you can imagine from 67 until 90, you speak about two generations. And I'm sure that each one of them, here or her, you know, they got married and now they have families. And you, if you can make a calculation, you speak about 700,000 Palestinians. They lost their residency there. And they lost their right to come back. This is just simple calculation. You know how they pushed Palestinians. Because they used to change the military order every 6 months, every year, things like that. If you stay outside without renewing your permit, you know, you lose your residency. And let me say in 6 months or something like that. They used also to make a calculation to say, if a mom, she has the ID, and the father hasn't, for instance, they have no right to register their children. And they did that according to their calculation. Who's more, females or males, they have, you know, IDs and residency. That's, according to that, they make the change all the time. They used to change, you know, the military order and setting new orders. This is just, it gives an idea. The economic means, administrative means, physical means, and I mean by physical means like restrictions of the movement. It's impossible for any Palestinians from other parts of West Bank to get in Jerusalem. It's like impossible. I had a case before the Israeli High Court when they imposed travel ban on me. And I received from the High Court, you know, a specific date just to discuss my case. And my lawyer, he is an Israeli lawyer. His name is, maybe you know him, Michal Sfart. He is a well-known lawyer. He submitted, you know, an application for me to get a permit to go just for my case. And they refused. What's the security? What's the security, for instance, if they don't let a mom, she is 80 years old, to go to visit her son in Israeli prisons under the security? And this is what they tell the ICRC when they're coordinating for the family visits of the Palestinian prisoners. What's the security behind, for instance, not to let a mom to go to join her daughter? And I'm here speaking about cases. I'm not speaking about just theoretical things from my mind. No, no. We documented all of these cases. Just to join her daughter or her son at the hospital in Jerusalem, he or she is sick with the cancer, and some of them, they were died, and their moms and fathers, they were away. And I'm here speaking about 14, 15, 16 years old boy, you know. This is the case. What's the security behind just to go with your beloved, you know, to the hospital, to join them, to be with them? I think this is the life, this is the daily life of Palestinians under the occupation. Occupation is a controlling system, controlling every aspect in your life. What I spoke about and what I'm speaking about now, it's the scene And we, all of us, we see that by our eyes and we feel it. But there are many things unseen. I think the purpose is to destruct the Palestinian community. That's to construct the structure of the Palestinian community. How? Many things, for instance. Today, anyone from Ramallah or Hebron or other cities in West Bank, when they think to get married or love with other one, his or her partner from Jerusalem, they have to address themselves 1,000 questions. If the Israeli will let them to stay together or not. Because if he or she is from Jerusalem, the other part, they can't stay in Jerusalem. And if he or she wants to join him in the other city, she or he will lose the residency. This is now the case. And it's applied only on Palestinians. What you can call these things, these policies and these practices, I will leave that for you to find the right definition.
You have been listening to Raji Sarani, Director of the Palestine Center for Human Rights, and Shawan Jabarin, Director of Al-Haq, the oldest human rights organization in the West Bank. And that is our program this morning. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature the courageous Israeli journalist Gideon Levy speaking at Brandeis University. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning. طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Coming up next, unwelcome guests. Techno-war means you fight war as a production process. The military became deeply impressed with big business's contributions in World War II. After World War II, the military then decided that not only would the supply operations be organized along corporate lines, but that actual conduct of warfare would be organized along corporate lines. The officer corps were the managers, the enlisted men were the workers. The product was enemy body count. Just as American business prided itself on high technology, capital-intensive production systems, so too would our military have high technology, capital-intensive warfare to outproduce. And the product then was enemy body counts. In American perspective, if the only thing that counts in warfare is technology and economics, both in your economy and how you translate your economy into your military, then it was impossible for us to lose. We would kill more of them than they would of us. That's techno-war. There are stories of where people from different units had to fight over arms and legs to determine who was going to get the kill count for their unit.
You're listening to episode 738 of Unwelcome Guests, Techno-War in Vietnam, Misadventures of the Market Model. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard from Professor William Gibson describing his, at the time, new book from 1987. I'm putting two episodes of the classic show Alternative Views back-to-back to give us a new angle on how the Vietnam War was conducted and why, and I think some food for thought for those who can see the application of the market mechanism all around them in areas which were never previously seen as markets. I've trimmed a little bit off the front and the end of both episodes and removed a bit of hesitation, but as usual, I shall link to both of the original audios. They'll be available for download from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/738.
Sighting down the long barrel, I wait till front and rear sights form a perfect line on his body, and then slowly squeeze the trigger. The thought occurs that I have never hunted anything in my whole life except other men.
Vietnam, America's longest war, its most costly war, its first military defeat, and its most nightmarish national trauma. People are still asking, what went wrong? How and why did the U.S. get involved? Was Vietnam a tragic mistake, as liberals claim? Did the U.S. lose because of self-imposed constraints, as conservatives claim? Could we have won the war if we just unleashed the military machine and bombed the North Vietnamese back to the Stone Age? What was the cost of Vietnam, the human cost, the political cost, the economic cost to both the United States and the Vietnamese? One person who has been researching these questions for over 10 years is William Gibson, who has just published a book, The Perfect War, Techno-War in Vietnam, with Atlantic Monthly Press. Bill is a graduate of the University of Texas, where he did his undergraduate work, and he got his PhD at Yale University and is now a professor of sociology at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And we're very pleased to have you with us today on Alternative Views, Bill, to discuss your Vietnam book.
This is an incredible book, Bill. If you have read a lot about Vietnam, or if you have never read anything about Vietnam, this is the one you should read, because it shows the picture from the top, from the bottom, and it gives an explanation as to what really happened there and why things happened. Usually you come back with kind of an empty feeling of frustration or not really knowing, but you, after reading your book, you understand, which is incredible.
Oh, thank
thing.
You.
And you get the emotional feeling, the impact, as well as what was happening in the mines. And these incredible stories like how the North Vietnamese were able to bring down American jets just by lying on their back and firing 45s and rifles up into the sky. But I'm getting ahead of the story.
Yes, Bill, let's begin by talking about what, in your opinion, is distinctive about the Vietnam War. What brought about U.S. involvement in this ill-fated adventure?
The most distinctive feature of the Vietnam War is that it was the first war in modern times to be fought from a managerial business perspective. During World War II, U.S. industry made a massive contribution to the war effort, and American military men and political leaders fully appreciated that effort. During World War II, the military partially adopted a business model of organization for their supply operation. After World War II, they began to think of combat as also a production process. The officer corps were seen not as gladiator heroes who were leading men in combat, but as war managers. In turn, the enlisted men were no longer the citizens of a nation, but they were workers. Managers and workers worked on a production line to produce deaths, and the product then was enemy body counts. So just as American society's strength, supposedly, was high technology, capital-intensive business, so too would we fight wars as high technology, capital-intensive warfare, and we would literally drive the other side bankrupt. So it's this production model of war, or what I call techno-war, that distinguishes, at a primary structural level, Vietnam from other warfare.
And so then in this way, we couldn't lose, because we were fighting a small, underdeveloped, untechnical third world country with peasants, basically.
Exactly. From an American perspective, if the only thing that counts in warfare is technology and economics, both in your economy and how you translate your economy into your military, then it was impossible for us to lose. It was theoretically impossible for an underdeveloped peasant economy to beat the United States. It just couldn't happen. Therefore, whenever we ran into a problem in 54 or 60 or 64, at every time the U.S. was defeated, we always thought that if we escalated to the next highest level, we would win. It's a closed system.
And Bill, why was Vietnam chosen as the site for the first techno war?
There's no historical reason for Vietnam. In other words, really, Vietnam as a country, as a people, as a culture, didn't really matter to the Americans. So there was nothing about the country per se to make us fight there. It was simply the time when this whole apparatus of warfare was developing, vis-a-vis the time when the situation in Vietnam was deteriorating from an American perspective. Techno war, or this production model of war, got its big push in the 50s. Because after World War II, when we had the hydrogen bomb or the atomic bomb, and then later the hydrogen bomb, and the Russians didn't, it seemed clear to us that our mastery of the world was just unsurpassed and we could not be challenged. But when the Russians had the bomb, we were in a situation of potentially mutual destruction, where they could destroy our industrial apparatus, then this made the Americans feel impotent. And so the question came is, how can we develop a form of warfare to and exercise our power in the world without threatening nuclear war? And the idea developed by Dr. Henry Kissinger, who at the time was a professor at political science at Harvard, was what's called limited war. And the idea was, because our economy was so big and powerful, we could have guns and butter. Butter and TVs and popcorn and drive-ins and hula hoops for the Americans at home. And limited war for an indefinite period of time in the Third World. And because we were so much richer, we would just drive the other side bankrupt.
And it was a period where certain guerrilla movements, certain national liberation movements were emerging. We saw the Cuban Revolution in 1959, and there were Third World revolutionary movements throughout Latin America,
Africa,
South.
The French and British empires were deteriorating worldwide. Certainly, right. You know, and Vietnam's a classic case of that. Vietnam mm-hmm. had been a French colony that right. went through a long process of revolt. So Vietnam was just simply, it was ready. We had our theory for limited war, and we had our apparatus in place at the time Vietnam was by the time the French had been thrown out.
Can you give us a brief history of Vietnam and their struggle, first against the Chinese and then the French, et cetera, leading up to American intervention?
Certainly. The word Vietnam originally, it means Southern Kingdom of the Viet, and it was a part of China that, well, it didn't really break off. It's like Chinese immigrated there, and they formed a racially distinct group and tried to claim independence. Chinese emperors would invade Vietnam, hold the country for several hundred years. Vietnamese guerrilla fighters would throw the Chinese out. The Chinese would then invade and hold it for another 50-100 years. Then the Vietnamese would throw them out and hold on for 50 years. This struggle between Vietnam and China for Vietnamese independence went on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Finally, by the time the Vietnamese had finally defeated China, they were weak, though. But this is the time when the West was expanding, and France was looking for a way to get to China for the spice trade and so on, and they ended up taking Vietnam. So France took Vietnam as a colony in the 1890s. Vietnamese fought off and on against the French from the 1890s on up. Oh, they just kept on fighting. But then in World War II, the communists, especially headed by Ho Chi Minh and Vo Nguyen Giap and Lê Đức Thọ, organized better. They fought against the Japanese, and then after declared their independence in 45, and ironically, American intelligence operatives supported that effort extensively.
And Ho Chi Minh, as I understand it, looked at that time to the United States as a model to develop his country, not to the Soviet Union.
His position was that he had paid off whatever he felt he ideologically owed to the Soviet Union, and that he was a free agent, he was not getting any assistance, and that the America, with the Declaration of Independence and with its stated anti-imperialist policy, was a far better possible ally.
And it was a model of democracy for him, too, and at that time he was a nationalist and a Democrat to some extent.
Certainly a nationalist. How much a Democrat? I'm not. I wouldn't. He was pretty much.
He at least paid lip service to the democratic values and the anti-imperialist.
But certainly a nationalist.
Yeah. Well, then the Vietnamese defeated the French
in '54 after 8 years of extensive warfare, extensive guerrilla warfare. And it's important for us to understand the war in Vietnam was one country. It had been tentatively divided into three administrative zones by the French, but warfare was going on in all three. When the war ended in 54, the country looked like a checkerboard. Some French in the north, some Vietnamese or Viet Minh in the north. Some French cities held in the south, other areas held by the Vietnamese communists. North and South Vietnam didn't exist. It was only a checkerboard. But then, at the Geneva peace talks in 1954, there was a land swap. Vietnamese forces moved north, French consolidated their forces in the south. A line was drawn, a provisional administrative boundary, not a national boundary, not a political boundary, an administrative zone boundary. And the idea was the country would be divided for 2 years and there would be international elections in 56. There were no such elections. The United States moved in. But what's important to understand, this idea of North Vietnam as a separate country that invaded South Vietnam is wrong. There was no North and South Vietnam as two separate countries. That was a checkerboard at the end of 54 that got changed.
And what happened in the South to begin the resistance struggle?
In 54, the Viet Cong in the South were told to put down their guns and that they were going to engage in political struggle for 2 years in preparation for the 56 elections. That became extremely dangerous. Diem, the man the Americans put in power, immediately went after and hunted down most of the communists, leftists, Democrats, nationalists. In other words, Diem and his family ruled Vietnam pretty much as a dictatorship. And finally, by the late 50s, the local communist and guerrilla and socialist and democratic apparatus was taking casualties so badly that they had to renew the armed struggle to survive. And so simply then the Southern cadres put pressure on the North, on the Communist Party, to like reopen the military front and have a joint political and military strategy as opposed to simply trying to wait for international intervention or by the United Nations or something. So that's the origin of resistance.
Now, what was the U.S. response to this then?
Well, the response was quite simple. This is... When the Green Berets, who had originally been formed to parachute into Eastern Europe after to organize guerrilla movements in Eastern Europe, got reformulated as counterinsurgency experts, and they were sent to Vietnam by President Kennedy in 1960. There was also a massive increase in CIA operations. The whole idea of covert warfare, remember, and counterinsurgency warfare. Remember, we had failed at the Bay of Pigs in 1961? And so the idea was that we must become experts at fighting these wars of national liberation, and that we must have new warrior technicians who could intervene in underdeveloped countries and fix things. And the Green Berets were one branch of fix-it men, CIA operatives were another, various logistics people, economists were others. Mm-hmm. We should remember that. To understand the class structure of Vietnam, it's a poor rural society. Most of the people are landless peasants or own very small plots of land. They're under subsistence agriculture, where a large part of their crop goes to the landlord. A small landowning class, most peasants are Buddhist with practiced elements of Confucianism as well. A small landowning class, many of them are refugees from the north, many of them Catholic, controls the nation's wealth. So Diem and the government, Diem uses then the army as a mechanism to collect rents. And during the first war against the French, the Viet Cong had redistributed the land to the peasantry. So when Diem came to power in 54 with the army and acted as agents of the landlord to collect years of back rent, essentially the internal class polarization increased one more time.
And drove people of the Viet Cong into revolutionary perspective.
Exactly.
And then Diem had to use more and more repression as a result of the dissatisfaction of the
And the repression in turn meant that, in essence, that the Viet Cong or communist forces felt like they had to resort to armed struggle again.
So this is why you made your statement in your book that Diem had an army, but he was not a government.
That's right. No, there was no effective administration other than military administration. Diem eventually replaced all forms of village council, all forms of intermediary powers that had any linkage to below were destroyed. Instead, all loyalty was from the top down.
Yet the American escalation didn't really dramatically accelerate until after Diem's assassination. What brought about this dramatic acceleration and what you call techno war to Vietnam?
When Diem was gone, all the other Vietnamese generals began a power struggle among themselves. Consequently, whatever government repressive apparatus Diem had collapsed. Desertions increased radically. Defections to Viet Cong units became stronger and stronger. By 64, American policymakers feared that there would be a provisional revolutionary government, an open provisional revolutionary government in much of the countryside, which we had lost.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, it's straight. U.S. forces lost, or the French lost, in 45. We lost again in 54. We lost again in 63, 64. We escalate. The United States escalates in the face of defeat,
mm-hmm.
not in the face of victory.
Right.
So massive defeat in 63 and 64 brought in then the need for U.S. ground troops and sustained bombing of the North in order to try to salvage the situation.
Why couldn't the U.S. accept a defeat in this small corner of the world?
The United States has been unwilling to deal with communism as a political, social, and economic movement. Instead, it gets seen that we as Americans are the natural beings of the world, and that capitalism is the natural economic order, and that our system is simply the essence of human goodness and the essence of nature. Therefore, something very, very different from us is not another society with whom one compares differences and makes treaties with and so on and so forth, but instead is an alien presence. If we're nature, they're anti-nature, or what I call the foreign other. During World War II, the Soviet Union did take over, right after World War II, did invade and take over Eastern Europe. The Red Army did, and you had to hold it as a buffer zone, and they did install puppet dictatorships there. This became the model for all American views of communist and socialist of any kind. Americans did not understand internal revolution. They did not understand the Chinese Revolution in the 40s, that there were like millions upon millions of poor peasants who wanted land to survive, and that Mao Zedong and the Communist Party offered them land and survival, whereas Chiang Kai-shek was a warlord who offered them nothing. So, unable to see internal struggles for socialism or communism, or unable to see even internal struggles for national independence against colonialism,
right,
the world gets divided into them and us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. They are the foreign other. They're trying to move in. So all forms of communism movements get seen in that light. So in this sense, then, any particular movement in the world is not just a particular movement in a dirt-poor country. And let's remember how dirt-poor Vietnam is then. And we had very little investment there. Instead, any movement is a sign of the global movement. A victory,
by the Soviet Union.
A few poor peasants win in Vietnam. That doesn't mean just that they have that a little few more people have a few more rights. Instead, that means that the foreign other, the monolithic machine, has encroached one more step, and that with each other step, the rest of the world becomes in peril. This, of course, is the domino theory. So like a contagious disease, sort of, instead of like each country having its own history and its own culture and its own people. It's as if the world is an empty shell, like a chessboard, and it's either our side or their side, and once they get going, just somehow a mechanistic momentum will propel communism to victory. It's a very, I call it mechanistic anti-communism, because it's a mechanistic framework of the world, and the enemy is is foreign other. They aren't really real enemy at all. It's an abstraction.
So isn't that also, aren't there two sides of this? The other side is the people, the big decision makers, the foreign policy establishment, as you term it, looking at the world on a more realistic basis. As General Maxwell Taylor said in his book, we have to keep an iron grip on the third world country because they're poor and they want riches, and the riches would have to come from us. So they look at any type of victory, such as in Vietnam, as providing an example to other third world countries that if they can do it and get away with it in Vietnam, they can get away with it in other
countries.
So it's
a universal sign. The victory in Vietnam is a universal sign of national liberation victory everywhere. A defeat in Vietnam means that all liberation movements will give up their struggles.
So, Bill, given the fact of this military-industrial complex in the United States that had built up a new military machine and model of warfare, given the mechanistic anti-communism that was motivating the foreign policy decisions of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, and given the collapse of the Diem South Vietnamese government in Vietnam, it was almost inevitable that U.S. involvement would intensify, that this war was not an accident, that this war was not just a policy mistake, but it was a consequence, basically, of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. industrial and military development since World War II, that this was the test case. This is where they had to test their war machine and stop communism.
I really want to stress together that I am one of the principal arguments I'm trying to, critique in my book is this notion that we just made one mistake after another, that nobody was really responsible for anything, that things just sort of slipped up. You don't go to war that way. You go to war far, far in advance. In 64, when Johnson was making announcements about the Gulf of Tonkin and just sort of like how it was a surprise attack, which it wasn't, and in early 65, when they were making announcements to the American public that maybe we'd send a few thousand more troops to Vietnam, they fully expected to send 200,000 people by the end of 65, another 100,000 by 66, and another 100,000 by 67. It was the estimates were already there that it'd be take a half million men.
So they had planned
it was a
planned
out war. This was a planned warfare, a planned escalation.
Well, let's talk about the war itself and see how this techno war actually worked out itself in the ground and in the air. The use of helicopters, the helicopter war, and the search and destroy. Can you describe these and how they worked?
Well, let me quote a very famous general, Julian Ewell. Generals write books. They're kind of like academicians. They need to, write to publish in order to get further promoted up the hierarchy. We normally don't believe that, but or think that way, but it's true.
And to justify their actions.
And just to justify their actions. All right, Ewell's book is called Sharpening the Combat Edge, The Use of Analysis to Reinforce Military Judgment. It's published by the Department of the Army. And in the first chapter, Ewell says that we could compare search and destroy operations in Vietnam to an assembly line.
Wow.
That it was literally a war factory, and that the objective was unlike a World War II or World War I, where you have a continuous front going on thousands of miles, and you have major offensives and then a counteroffensive and then a lull. In Vietnam, it's a factory. You turn the factory on, you let it run full blast all the time. And that's the managerial problem. How do you just allocate your resources, given the fact that you've already decided to run at maximum capability?
To produce body counts.
To produce body counts. Search and destroy means that somewhere between several hundred and several thousand American soldiers are going to search a block of countryside for Viet Cong or North Vietnamese troops, and they're going to try to engage them in combat and, of course, and destroy whatever troops or whatever supplies they capture. In theory, it's strategic offensive, meaning it's a way to put the Viet Cong, make them weaker, put them on to hunt them down. It's as if we're hunters and they're the prey. The objective is to kill the enemy so fast that we reach what's called the crossover point. This is General William Westmoreland's term. The crossover point means you're killing the enemy faster than they can replace their casualties. It's like you're going to drive the other side bankrupt. All right, so with all of our high technology, with our helicopters, our jet fighter bombers, our tanks, we'll just grind them up. Now, that's the theory. The practice of search and destroy often turned out very differently. In that part of simply of a factory means a set of routine operations. And these routines were quite visible to the Vietnamese. For example, we just didn't all of a sudden show up unannounced into an area and begin the search. Instead, you had to, like, reconnaissance planes had to go over it. Artillery guns had to shoot smoke rounds into the jungle, into the landing zone, so that all the other artillery guns could sight in so they could, like, fire protective artillery strikes around the landing zone. If you're any kind of Viet Cong commander, if you see a smoke round coming up in the jungle, well, you know that the Americans are getting ready to launch a helicopter assault. There aren't that many clear zones, like clear areas in mountainous territory or in swamps or in jungle. You can tell where the landing zones are. So many times the Viet Cong commanders had a very substantial advance notice upon when the Americans were going to begin an operation. Consequently, they had the choice, do we run and hide or do we ambush? The Americans then land. The second or first wave takes the landing zone. The second and third waves bring in more artillery. If you're a Viet Cong commander, you get out your compass and your map. You draw a circle, a radius on the map, and that will tell you, because you know that American artillery, 105-millimeter howitzer, has a 10,000-meter radius. So you know that the Americans will not march further outside the range of their howitzers, so you can tell where the Americans are going to march. Do you run and hide, or do you fight? So the same kind of principle goes on. It's in essence, they knew where we were, but we did not know where they were.
And they had the initiative.
They then had the initiative.
It's their terrain.
It's their terrain. So in essence, even by the military's own statistics, roughly 3/4 of the battles in Vietnam were initiated by the Viet Cong and NVA, meaning they ambushed U.S. forces and could make a decision. Also, most battles ended when the Viet Cong and NVA wanted them ended. They could, like, initiate contact and break contact. And those are two crucial definitions of combat initiative.
And your other statistic that only in 2% of the search and destroy missions did we actually make contact, original contact with the Vietnamese. So it was their choice the whole time. And as I understand, the soldiers themselves on the ground, they didn't like this because they were the ones who would have to take the casualties first to lure the Vietnamese into battle so that then the Americans would know where to send the planes and where to send the artillery.
You send out a patrol in order to get it ambushed, in order to mark a target with a smoke rocket from a helicopter so that then the jets can come in and napalm the area. In other words, you have to get ambushed before you can find the enemy.
You know, when I began my Vietnam research, I had a hint that I was going to find a very cavalier attitude towards whether or not Vietnamese lived or died. I was surprised to understand the command's attitude towards their own soldiers. But let's think about it. We're talking about a production model of war again, or techno-war.
These are the U.S. war managers.
These are the U.S. war managers. We have a draft. We can replace all the labor that we lose can be replaced. And indeed, it's like migrant labor force. We're almost sort of like, say, we had a farm when you bring them in for a year. You know, a year
they're mostly blacks and Chicanos anyway.
Quite all, well, not most, but a whole lot of them are. They're poor working class whites. The idea was, so what if they walk into an ambush? We take some casualties that way, but then we'll call in our airstrikes and call in our artillery fire, and we'll use our technology then to get the body count. So, in essence, the ground troops were bait. They were being sent out on operations to be ambushed. And that's not a good way to survive in warfare.
Night movement. That was suicide. I was one of the worst patrols you could ever go out on. The purpose of it was for you to walk up on Charlie and for him to hit you, and then for our hardware to wipe them out. We were using scapegoats to find out where they were. That was all we were. Bait. Hell, they couldn't find Charlie any other way. So they loved us to run into a whole bunch of them. That way they could plaster him and they'd have a big body count. And the general gets another goddamn medal and a big promotion.
Let's also note again, the highest officer routinely on the ground during Vietnam was a captain. A captain was a company commander. A company had at most about 140 people in it. That would be at full strength. Most combat units never operate at full strength. Everyone above captain's level, a battalion commander is the man who commands four companies. All battalion level officers, brigades can have several battalions, divisions have several regiments or brigades. All the rest of those choppers, all the rest of those commanders are in helicopters flying at minimum at 1,500 feet, because 1,500 feet is the maximum range of a 50 caliber machine gun when used as an anti-aircraft weapon, which until the latter part of the war was the largest anti-aircraft weapon the Viet Cong had. So the managers were relatively safe in this process, whereas it's the workers who are suffering the occupational safety
hazards
on the ground.
Was it a success in terms of the numbers and the body counts? Did they actually, in their own inhuman logic, succeed? Or were the costs greater than the benefits, even in terms of their own logic?
Several things happened. For one, all the American commanders and helicopters communicated in uncoded English to their subordinate officers and ground troops. The Viet Cong and NVA were able to buy American radios in the black market and capture others. They routinely listened in into all the orders. There are many stories of people of Viet Cong hearing American orders and then taking actions to circumvent them. So the sheer arrogance of, you know, we're in our helicopters, we have all this stuff, we don't have to care, we don't have to pay attention to our enemy, that ended up costing American lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that part didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It took within a year or so, by late 66 or so, the Viet Cong and NVA knew how long it was going to take an American airstrike to get there. Now, sometimes they can make a terrible miscalculation and get caught out in the open. But an astute enemy commander could make a reasonable judgment on how long he could stay in combat before he had to run like hell, because the F-4s or the Hueys or the gunships were coming to after him. So a lot of times ambushes would be quite brief and the enemy would break off contact.
Well, we've mentioned body count a couple of times. Let's get into that and the whole framework of corruption and lies and cover-ups that occurred in the U.S.
It's simple from what we've followed so far. If the success in war is purely an enemy body count, yes, because we're trying to drive the other side bankrupt, and let's presume that, oh, you and Doug are, I'm a general, and that, like, your lieutenants are captains, right? Maybe you're a captain, company commander somewhere. You're under pressure. I'm under pressure to produce a body count. And as a colonel, say I'm a colonel battalion commander, if I don't meet my quota, my career is over with. I'll be relieved of command. And if you're relieved of combat command, then your ticket up the hierarchy is gone. So I'm going to squeeze you. And in fact, in some units, it kind of where the informal rule was, if you don't meet your body count quota, then we're going to, like, you're not coming in off the field. We'll just leave you. I'll bring you some more ammo, some more food, some more water, but don't expect, you know, you've got to, like, produce the goods.
I knew if I came back without a body count or at least a prisoner, I'd get my ass chewed. So I kept the patrol out. Well, I talked to many soldiers who were wounded, the ones I saw in Japan, and they told me that some units were given a quota for the week. And if they didn't get it, they were just sent right back out again.
All right, you're under pressure. You're under severe, severe pressure. But what do? Well, you can do several things. One, you can just invent a body count. You can just out of the thin air and just like, say, call up and have a, like, tell everyone in your unit, He'll tell your entire class there at UT to fire off their M16 for a minute, called a mad minute, and call up on the radio and report that you have a body count of 30 or a body count of 5 or something like that. Or say you get ambushed, Frank, and your whole company gets ambushed. You call in an airstrike and you call in an artillery strike, and there's an armored unit nearby, and you actually have an engagement and you find some enemy bodies. Well, what are you going to do? Well, if you found 10 bodies and you've got 3 different units, artillery, air, and infantry involved, who's going to get the credit? What if you don't give credit to the artillery? What do you think might happen then? What if you say you fired but you missed? Does that sound like a wise policy to you?
The artillery commander isn't going to give you any support the
next
time.
He might be kind of slow next time around. Or those F-4 pilots might have to have, they might get a little slow too. It's in your interest to reward everyone. And since everyone is under the same system, everyone needs body counts, why sure, we give you 50 Air Force, we give you 50 gunships, we give you 50 artillery, and we on the ground, I've got 5 bodies and I've got 5 rifles. We'll count each rifle as a 5 persons killed, so that gives us 25. And while we were out stumbling around, we found 10 graves. We'll count them too.
And body parts.
And body parts. Say we find an arm or a leg, and say, because sometimes really when the airstrikes did hit, you can't blow people to smithereens. Unlike the war movie where everyone has a nice discreet death,
yeah.
In a real war, it's quite gruesome. There are stories of where people from different units had to fight over arms and legs to determine who was going to get the kill count for their unit.
And, of course, it got even more pernicious because they would slaughter Vietnamese civilians and include them, I mean, children, women, old people, include them as part of the body count as well.
Well, we should get clear on that about... In some areas of the war where U.S. forces were fighting uniformed North Vietnamese troops, there weren't too many civilian casualties. But a whole lot of Vietnam battles occurred way inside the country where there were Viet Cong, and Viet Cong and the villagers were very much the same people.
Well, now on search and destroy missions, they told us to kill everything that moves. So we... killed everybody. Well, I just happened to be standing alongside the officer when the radio man said, "Look, sir, we've got some children rounded up. What do you want us to do with them?" And the officer says, "God damn it, Marine, you know what to do with them. Kill the bastards. If you ain't got the goddamn balls to kill a Marine, I'll come down and kill the bastards myself." And the Marine said, "Yes, sir," and hung up the phone. And about 2 or 3 minutes later, I heard a lot of automatic fire and a lot of children screaming. I heard babies crying. I heard children screaming their lungs out.
Search and destroy reached the point where if any, say, many units burn down villages routinely, and then you go in a village and you burn it and you see their bunkers there, because everyone in Vietnam had a bunker to hide in, and you hear a noise, and maybe you scream and try to get somebody out, but maybe you just throw the grenade in. Or people start to run away from you. And, well, if they run from you, they must be your enemy. And so you shoot them, and you say, well, running becomes a sign of an enemy.
Well, we'd been out for about 3 hours, and really hadn't seen anything. It was too hot. But then I saw this figure in black pajamas running along a paddy dike about 300 meters ahead and to the left. And, "Oh, hey, I got one," I hollered. 10 o'clock, he's mine." Then I muttered the warning to halt, you know, regulations. "Don't lie, don't lie." So I dropped to one knee, squeezed the trigger. Crack! Figure in black went flying like a piece of paper in a gust of wind. "Ho, we got some," Morgan shouted. "Nice shot, baby, nice shot," said Newcomb. When it reached the body, I nudged the corpse face up with my boot. It was a woman, about 55 to 60, And Wally says, "Stupid gook, what'd she run for?"
We were in a free fire zone, and we saw a woman and a child running across, and the captain says, "Well, there, they're running." Well, in the free fire zone, if they're running, they're wrong. They're the enemy. So we shot them. The whole squad opened up on them. The next morning, we went out, and we could see the cap of a child that was bloodied, and you could see where the mother had dragged the child away.
Troops are they're afraid, they're trying to survive, they're in a desperate situation, they're under a high pressure to produce a body count. So yes, we got into sustained slaughter of Vietnamese villagers. You go through and you look at a man's hands, and if he's a true farmer, he has calluses, and if he's a guerrilla who's only a fake farmer, he doesn't. So you go and you look at the hands, and those, if he doesn't have enough calluses, then you haul him away and you send him to an interrogation center. Or you look at the ankles. If a man is a gorilla, he must be running out there in the jungle getting his ankles all scratched up. Where if he's a farmer, he wouldn't have so many scratches. So American soldiers would go around and look at the ankles. Or if he's a gorilla, if you actually, you're a farmer by day and a fighter by night, you must not be getting much sleep. So you've got to have circles under your eyes. So U.S. soldiers would go in and look into the eyes of the Vietnamese and try to decide how many bags they had. And then if you have too many bags, you get hauled off. It was not our country. It was not our culture. We did not speak the language. And by the American way of looking at war, language, culture, history, class structure, these matters didn't matter. What matters, we had the hardware and they didn't.
Well, as the pilot of a helicopter gunship, we had a rule about the use of evasive action. Anyone taking evasive action could be fired upon. They never explained why or even what it was. But anyway, there was one incident I recall where we flew over a large rice paddy, and there were some people down there working in the rice paddy, maybe a dozen or 15 individuals. And we passed over their heads. Well, they didn't take any action, but we could tell they were nervous. But they didn't try to hide or anything. So we hovered just a few feet off the ground among them with our two helicopters, and we turned on our police sirens. And boy, when they heard the police sirens, they started to disperse. And so we opened up on them, just shot them all down.
Well, it was 6:30 in the evening. And still daylight, and they said there was some VC out there, and they called on us. So we fired out there and killed off seven of them. Well, the word comes back to us that we killed seven rice farmers carrying their hoes. They're trying to make it back to the village. You see, we'd set up this curfew, 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., and so it was up to them to be out of there by that time. But hell, they didn't carry any wristwatches. They didn't have any idea what time it was.
So, yes, people got hauled away for interrogation and never came back. Yes, many, many villages were burned to the ground and blown up. And yes, many, 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 many Vietnamese, men, women, children, chickens, water buffalo, pigs, piglets, often were killed. Oftentimes you went into a village, the stories are you shot everything.
And burned the crops.
And burned the crops.
And
that
their
was,
houses. And their houses.
And their houses.
Boy, you know, if the people don't treat you right when you walk through that village, you can give them hell. Yeah, they give you that snotty look they can do. You know, they won't say nothing to you. And we expected them to run out and welcome us like at World War II type of stuff. You know, hey, G.I., hey. Well, as soon as we step outside the village, the captain radios in, "We're under heavy contact." Then right away, those phantom jets start coming in and dropping them 500-pound bombs. The whole village is leveled. And we go on to the next village. And that is search and destroy.
All this was, I guess, part of what you call the mere gook rule.
Yes, essentially, if it's dead and it's Vietnamese, it's VC. You know, which, What it is armies have documents called rules of engagements that are supposed to specify when you can open up fire and when you can't.
On civilians.
On anyone.
Right.
But they weren't used much at all. Mm-hmm. Instead, other kind of rules happen. Like I said, if they run, they're an enemy. Mm-hmm. Or if they have black pajamas, that was one rule. Some units thought that any Vietnamese wearing black garb was the enemy. Of course, all peasants that wore that as their national dress. So there are all kinds of these fake rules that supposedly distinguish friend from foe. Mm-hmm. But all these rules were wrong in that we just didn't know the culture. They were kind of like fabrications that Americans invented to try to make themselves feel legitimate about who got shot. And but ultimately, people saw through this and said, look, what's in practice is this is the mere group rule. If it's dead and it's Vietnamese, it's VC. Any Vietnamese we shoot, we're going to count.
There's also the factor of racism, too. I wonder how much they would have done this if they'd been fighting Germans.
Oh, it's probably much less. Of course, it says gook, slope, slant, dink.
One definition of a dead Vietnamese was believers. If they'd been napalmed, they were called crispy critters. And a one-liner went, when we kill a pregnant woman, we count it as two VC, one soldier and one cadet. Now, what you do is you load all the friendly Vietnamese, onto ships and take them out to the South China Sea. And then you bomb the country flat. Then you sink the ships. I'd like to burn the whole country down and then start again with Americans. Bomb the schools and churches. Bomb the rice fields, too. Show the children in the courtyards just what napalm can do. Strafe the town and kill the people. Drop napalm in the square. Get out early every Sunday and catch them at their morning prayer. Throw candy to the Arvin. Gather them all around. Take your 20-millimeter cannon and mow the bastards down.
Yeah, and this also tapped a certain sadism, not only in soldiers in the field, but also intelligence people. There were people who would, you know, collect ears and fingers and even heads, and even intelligence people would admit that they really got off to beating up the people they were interrogating. You know, it gave him a nice buzz, a thrill to do it.
When you go through soldiers' novels and memoirs, many have made valiant efforts to try to talk about the perverse eroticism of warfare. Sadism, clearly a very strong sadist dimensions, a lot of rape in the field, as well as killing, or a lot of rapes followed by killings and mutilations.
Well, maybe four or five of us, we'd go into the village and take a girl and bring her out into the jungle. We'd tell her to lie on the ground and don't scream, otherwise we'd kill her immediately. And then, how many of her guys there were, they did what they want to with her. If the guys were in a good mood, they let her go. They weren't, they'd kill her. Well, the girls were unconscious after they'd been repeatedly raped. And then after they got through raping them, three of the GIs took hand flares and they shoved them in the girls' vaginas. The girls were bleeding from their mouths and noses and faces and vaginas. Then the GIs lighted the exterior portion of the flares and they exploded inside the girls. Their stomachs just exploded. Well, one day I was driving back, driving on a back road, and a guy comes over to me and he says he needs some gasoline. Didn't say why. Well, I look over and I see this girl, and she's stripped and she's tied to two wooden stakes. I don't know what they'd done to her before I got there. Well, they poured gasoline all over the girl, and they lighted it. They lit it, and then they just stood there and watched her burn up.
It's if you look at a body count system and you see if that's the only thing that counts, right? The body count. If that's what rewards and punishments are distributed by, if that's your ethic, and if your own command doesn't really care whether you survive, then clearly you're in a world where anything goes.
It becomes a brutalized
war for survival. Or it becomes where people part people. It becomes a war for survival or a war to hold on to your ethics. I think a good example of this, Oliver Stone's movie Platoon, which is currently in releasement, shows a U.S. military unit that's severely divided between one group who commits atrocities and others who thinks it's a horrible, horrible situation. And I think that's a good illustration of probably the kind of dynamics that occurred in many, many units. It isn't as if everyone is a killer or a sadist. It's as if you're in a structure where a significant component of your troops engage in such behavior, but not everyone.
So it seems that then, you know, we talk about atrocities and we talk about My Lai. When you use that term atrocity,
it applies an exception to the rule. That's not a good way to look at it here.
But My Lai and atrocities were just business as usual.
Yes. My Lai seems a little well organized, in particular well organized, but certainly My Lai wasn't the only village in Vietnam that was burned down and where everybody inside it was shot. That is not true at all.
In fact, Bill, it was precisely this inability on the ground war to distinguish between friend and foe, VC and peasant farmer, that led to the next dimension of techno war, the pacification programs. The fact that they weren't able to tell who the enemy was meant that they had to clear out the whole countryside.
Certainly. Simply, if you can't tell friend from foe, then you depopulate the countryside and move them into concentration camps and move them into urban slums. It's not easy to depopulate a countryside. There are several major techniques. One is defoliation. You simply destroy the food base of the country. And this is where Agent Orange comes in. Mm-hmm. Agent Orange and Agent Blue and Agent White were sprayed on millions of acres of cropland. Other millions of acres of forest were defoliated. So with the food base gone, people have to move. Secondly, certainly bombing attacks on villages, which were quite extensive, encourage people to move. And then third, actual search and destroy operations where villages, some of which everyone is killed, others of which you simply surround the village, move everyone out, then burn up the village and move them, remove them. These three modes, millions and millions of Vietnamese lost their homes and were sent to concentration camps into urban slums. And what's so interesting is the Americans saw this as progress. This was urbanization. Rural is bad, urban is good. So even though they have nothing, it was brought as seen as a sign of progress to bring Vietnamese in where you could show them TV and make them work in American bases and so on and so forth. Was seen as having a more sophisticated job than being a peasant farmer.
This is also part of that same syndrome of not seeing the enemy as a culture or as individuals or people, but seeing them just as mirror images of ourselves, like the bombing of North Vietnam was supposed to hurt them if they destroyed their capacity to have consumer goods.
Certainly, and so the same idea, you would think from the American perspective that no Vietnamese cared about their home. They didn't care about their land and their dog and their ancestors' grave and their rice fields and their trees. That instead, simply just to have this new good, have this, quote, consumer good, or live in the urban area, that in itself was just an unmitigated good. You're right. People's lives were not important. The human dimension was completely lost. And instead, in America, instead, we can count. How many TVs were imported this month? How many Hondas?
Yeah,
so the logic of techno-war was inapplicable to Vietnam in a way.
Certainly, that's exactly. It could, in many ways, it created tremendous destruction, but it could not stop a very powerfully united people who were trying to change their lives.
In fact, this will be our topic for our next program. We're running out of time for today. And next week, we'll see the limitations of techno-war, of why it failed in Vietnam. We'll also discuss what's wrong with the liberal and conservative interpretations of Vietnam. We'll see what lessons we can draw from the Vietnam experience.
We also will talk about some other aspects of the Vietnam War, the Tet Offensive, for instance,
That was a big turning point in the war, and a lot of revisionist historians, particularly conservatives, said that it was an American victory. Was it or was it not? We'll also talk about this fascinating phenomenon in which the American army pretty much refused to fight, or many elements in it did. As a matter of fact, they started attacking their own officers and senior enlisted people in this phenomenon known as fragging.
And we'll conclude with a discussion of some of the parallels to Central America, of some of the failures of U.S. policy in Central America and how they can be illuminated by the failures of the policy in Vietnam. So, Bill, thanks for coming tonight.
Well, thanks, Doug.
This was
an
interesting, informative discussion, and we'll look forward to next week.
I'll be there.
And we're going to continue with the next episode from Alternative Views in just a minute. But before we do so, I think it's pertinent just to have a gentle reminder that, of course, we shouldn't necessarily be judging these implemented policies by their stated aims and objectives. One quote which springs to mind in connection with the Vietnam War is attributed to President Lyndon Johnson by his briefing officer, Colonel John Downey, who quotes Johnson as stating that he couldn't end the war because, quote, "my friends are making too much money," unquote. Now, that could be a reference to all sorts of war profiteering. If you've read Catch-22, you'll be aware of some of the things that can go on in wars. It makes immediate sense to apply the model of greedy self-interest to the supposed failure of their rule about having maximum number of sorties. Well, if that does increase the aircraft loss rate, well, that's increasing the profitability of those who would sell aircraft to the US military. I think Johnson was probably talking about the cabal who put him in power, and according to Alfred McCoy and Peter Dale Scott, it was during the Vietnam War that the international heroin trade was greatly ramped up and streamlined. So I think that formed the basis of international drug dealing as it continued through operations such as Iran-Contra right up to the present day. And these were people who had more or less put Lyndon Johnson in power, shared the guilty secret of the JFK assassination. So these are people with whom LBJ had a very strong connection. Now we continue with the next part. This is episode 317 of Alternative Views.
If you were a high Vietnamese general or colonel in the South Vietnamese government, army positions were like business positions. And it was most American aid was on the, it was for sale on the international market by the time it arrived. The level of theft is unbelievably high. And the only reason, it's like rather than try to control the theft, the American government essentially made the decision, look, theft by the officer corps is the price we have to pay for continuing the war. If you're a woman, the estimates are that there were like 500,000 Vietnamese women engaged in some kind of commercial sex. Military war managers devised ways to maximize sortie rates. It's like a factory. You keep doing the same routine. What this meant for pilots was that they died. The entire society was organized as a giant anti-aircraft system. And for really low level, Vietnamese peasants were under instructions to simply get out in the fields en masse, lie down, and shoot up in the air to try to provide a barrage that would make low altitudes unsafe for American pilots. And it happened. From mid-68 on, the American military began to become progressively more restless, and certainly by late 69, 70s, in active revolt against its commanders. So people began what's called fragging. Fragging means you take a fragmentation grenade and you throw it at your superior, whether it's a non-commissioned officer, sergeant, or a lieutenant, or a captain, or whatever. It was a way to tell higher command not to treat the ground troops' lives frivolously. My analysis says the U.S. had to get out because we couldn't fight, because we had an army that wouldn't do it anymore.
Guys would come in and they'd say no more than, "I'm tired of fighting this war." I try to find out what the war meant to them, what it was like, including some of the guilt.
And all they'd say was, "I've done a lot of killing, and I'm not sure it's right." Well, they'd been on sweeps of villages with orders to leave nothing living, not even chickens or water buffaloes. Well, what did that mean, following orders like that? Wasn't Lieutenant Callie and me lie, wasn't it that stirred up this in the first place? Hell, they were doing a me lie every day. They'd be out on a mission and call in airstrikes. Napalm would be sprayed, and the people would be burning. Sometimes they'd put them out of their misery. The guys who did that are still coming into the veteran centers with this on their mind 12 years later.
Bill Gibson, who wrote an incredible book about the Vietnam War called The Perfect War, Techno-War. And his book, The Perfect War, Techno-War in Vietnam, was recently published by Atlantic Monthly Press and has so far received some extremely good reviews. It was favorably reviewed in the Wall Street Journal. Kirkus Review described it as a perceptive, cogent, significant, and so far the best analysis of the meaning of America's only military defeat. Highly recommended. Gloria Emerson, in a review, described the book as, "Although many valuable books on the war exist as records of pain and endurance, there is no work that achieves what this does. Because he might just save us from our most comfortable lies and sad delusions, William Gibson should be honored." And John Stockwell describes this book as, "In all of my research on the subject, I have found nothing to compare with Dr. Gibson's Perfect War for invaluable insights into U.S. methodology and its hideous results in the war."
Tonight we're going to talk about the things we didn't cover. We're going to talk about Tet, the importance of that, the Tet Offensive. We're going to talk about how the United States Army, a lot of them didn't, they decided they weren't going to fight that war anymore. We're going to have an evaluation of the Vietnam War. How do people look at it from various aspects? And we'll also take a final look at, have we learned our lessons, or are we still fighting techno-war in Central America, or at least planning to?
What is your interpretation of techno-war? How do we get involved in Vietnam?
Techno-war means you fight war as a production process. The military became deeply impressed with big business's contributions in World War II. After World War II, the military then decided that not only would the supply operations be organized along corporate lines, but that actual conduct of warfare would be organized along corporate lines. The officer corps were the managers, the enlisted men were the workers. The product was enemy body count. Just as American business prided itself on high technology, capital-intensive production systems, so too would our military have high technology, capital-intensive warfare to outproduce. We would kill more of them than they would of us. That's techno-war. Why was it applied in Vietnam? Because after World War, in the 50s, the Soviets had the atomic bomb. They could then destroy our economy, or the base of our power, if we intervened militarily in the war, in the world with too much force. The object then was to fight limited war for indefinitely in the third world. We would just send our production system over there and drive the other side bankrupt. Why Vietnam? Americans saw communism not as another type of social organization, as another culture, as another political system, but instead they saw Americans as the good, the natural, the godlike, and the communism was a foreign other, an alien kind of being. The world was divided into simply two types of people, communist and non-communist, and therefore it was like debit or credit, their side or our side. By the time the Vietnamese overthrew the French in the late 50s, we had our theory of limited war intact. We had our conventional forces ready to go by the late 50s. Vietnam was simply a convenient mode, place to test out this new theory of warfare, techno-war, and a place to drive the foreign other back.
In fact, you pointed out something fascinating in your book about how a major part of U.S. support at a certain part
of the war was to win the hearts and the minds of the Vietnamese through importing U.S. commodities to them.
Yes.
The U.S. government actually put up the money to import these commodities and created the whole infrastructure for it. And rather than winning the hearts and minds of the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese people, it just created more corruption and inequality. Do you want to talk about that aspect of U.S.
policy? It's just hard for us to realize how much money was poured into that country in so many ways. If you were a high Vietnamese general or colonel in the South Vietnamese government, army positions were like business positions. And it was most American aid was on the, it was for sale on the international market by the time it arrived. The level of theft is unbelievably high. And the only reason, it's like rather than try to control the theft, the American government essentially made the decision, look, theft by the officer corps is the price we have to pay for continuing the war. So therefore, in order that something reaches the Vietnamese people, we'll just send more and more and more. And there was an element of truth in that, but also the greater truth was that simply corruption became compounded and the riches became greater. We're talking about millions and millions upon hundreds of millions of dollars made, or even currency manipulation. Currency fraud was endemic. If you knew how to play the game, you could get rich simply by exchanging your money from dollars to piastres to military script and back again. You know, just nothing, just by playing with the rules a little bit. So, but it didn't. It created massive inflation. It meant that life for most people got worse. It's what were your jobs available while a few people on top were able to make money off this stealing the American aid? On the bottom, what were your jobs open for you? Well, you could work for the Americans. You could work on their base. You could be an interpreter, maybe if you had minimal language skills. These are all if you're a man. If you're a woman, the estimates are that there were like 500,000 Vietnamese women engaged in some kind of commercial sex. Prostitution, massage parlors, however you want to call it, hooch girls. It's a whole multi-levered sexual marketplace.
Drugs is another
drugs,
major business factor.
Huge heroin importation coming from all places, coming from Laos. And the CIA was running a war in Laos with the Hills people and with the Laotian government. In order to buy the leaders of the Hills people and buy the Laotian government, they had to acquiesce to the heroin trade. Tons of heroin were brought in on Air America planes and Vietnamese Air Force planes, were refined in Bangkok and other places and sold in to U.S. soldiers in Vietnam.
South Vietnamese civil and military leadership was also heavily involved in the narcotics business. General and subsequent President of the Republic of Vietnam, Nguyen Van Thieu, ran one major operation, while Nguyen Cao Ky, the Times Air Marshal, Premier, and Vice President, ran another.
For orphans, what could you do? Shoeshine business wasn't something kids had to make money on the side. Shining shoes was life or death issue. Going through garbage dumps. You know, a very dismal life in this new urban Vietnam, not a consumer paradise. So,
and then the other hand, you had the black market, where, as you say in your book, you could buy anything. You could even buy tanks, armored personnel carriers, and of course the Viet Cong were tapping
Vietnam
into this.
Vietnam could equip themselves whenever they needed American goods. They could equip themselves without any problem. Yeah.
The other aspect of U.S. policy was air war. Part of your most brilliant chapters and descriptions in your book are of the magnitude and nature of the air war in Vietnam that was mainly, I guess, directed against North Vietnam. Do you want to discuss some elements of air war?
If war is a factory, then clearly when you look at air war, we've got the biggest factory and they have nothing. By American reasoning, the North Vietnamese should have given up the day the first bombs dropped on North Vietnam because they had such a small industrial apparatus, such a small number of bridges and things that you would think they would have just given up. But they didn't. They were willing to sacrifice their industrial apparatus. They were willing to absorb a massive casualties. And indeed, contrary to American mythology, where the Viet Cong were simply being totally supported from the North, roughly 80% of the supplies the Viet Cong used, and even the 80% of supplies the NVA used, were raised in the South. A small number of supplies were sent south. It couldn't be stopped. No matter how hard the U.S. bombed, no matter how much it escalated its campaigns, no matter even after they closed the ports at Haiphong and started systematically bombing the railroad lines between China and Vietnam, it couldn't stop it. The number of supplies wasn't that great. On the other hand, the air war did mobilize the North Vietnamese people to a considerable degree. Everyone had a job of one kind or another, either repairing the railroads, repairing the roads, or taking over industry, or working in agriculture. So it mobilized and consolidated that society to carry on, much like the Nazi attack on Great Britain consolidated British morale in World War II.
But on the other hand, people used to say, well, we ought to bomb them back to the Stone Age, and we just practically did, didn't we?
Most people don't recognize that the United States Air Force and Navy dropped between 8 million and 15 million tons of bombs and rockets on Southeast Asia. In all of World War II, the United States dropped 2.1 million tons. So the minimum estimate then is about four times greater than World War II, and it goes up to almost eight times greater than World War II.
In
Westmoreland's 1967 report, he has a target category summary. And the largest category in there after vehicles is buildings. When you listen to the reports of foreign observers on the ground, what they report is just about any modern stone or brick structure over one story was hit. Because those were the only things that looked like targets. And in essence, a lot of those were churches, a lot of them were hospitals, a lot of them were schools. Yes, North Vietnam was bombed back to the Stone Age. There's no doubt about that.
But because they were not fighting a techno war,
it didn't cripple them.
Now, we saw in the previous program where this production assembly line type of attitude resulted in the demand for body count for the land troops. In the air war, they also had production quotas, did they not?
And the organization of this was, all right, the unit of measurement is called a sortie. That's one flight by one airplane. And Air Force squadrons, wings, Air Force, you hope, large units have rates of production that they are supposed to meet. The Navy and the Air Force and indeed were in competition with each other to see who could, quote, be the most productive. Therefore, the object was to fly as many missions as possible within a finite period of time, like a week or a month or whatever. So rather than pay attention to really what you were bombing or to pay attention to the safest way to protect your pilots and the way to minimize civilian casualties, instead, military war managers devised ways to maximize sortie rates and consequently entered into serious irrational behavior. They, like in ground war, where U.S. commander treated their own ground troops as expendable, higher command treated pilots as expendable. They would often be sent on missions on, say, looking for trucks in the middle of rainstorms when it's impossible to see trucks from because the ground, you know, you can't even see the ground when you're 500 feet above it. But that keeps the sortie rate high. Or also, say you're supposed to, you know it's raining over a given target, and it's the target's clouding in, but you still send your planes up there every day, 5 days in a row, by the exact same route, in order so that, because that's simply, it's like a factory, you keep doing the same routine.
Well, we sure telegraphed our punches. There weren't all that many targets in that area, and it didn't take too many smarts to figure out about where the Air Force was headed. Especially when we headed them there day after day, making them fly up to the target before making the go or no-go decision on the weather that we already knew was not acceptable. And then we turned over the target and came back again the next day to try again.
What this meant for pilots was that they died, because the Vietnamese clearly understood where the Americans were flying the same pattern every day, and they understood that they would just keep coming. So what often frequently Vietnamese did was simply move more and more anti-aircraft guns into an area that the Americans for some reason wanted to bomb. And what ended up is American pilots ended up just fighting flying missions against empty targets surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of anti-aircraft weapons. And in this way, by telegraphing our punches, American pilots died.
I talked with a couple of nearly apoplectic F-4 pilots at Da Nang who told me they'd gone out recently on a four-plane mission carrying a very small bomb load. One pilot told me he was gritting his teeth, he was so mad. "We risked eight guys," he said, "when we could have hung the whole load on one plane, risking only two people, and done the job better." Well, then I asked him, "Well, why did they send out four planes?" The pilot said, "Damned if I know, unless it's just to keep our sortie rate high. But I tell you this, it's a goddamn crime." Well, you know, I heard about this sortie business on aircraft carrier Constellation. The Navy pilots had told me they could do a better job with a few A-6s operating in the safety of darkness than with all those Skyhawks skimming around with light loads in daylight. So while it didn't seem possible, it appeared that the Navy was trying to out-sortie the Air Force, and the Air Force was trying to out-sortie the Navy. And the guys who were flying the sorties took a dim view of it.
You had an incredible story in your book about how the North Vietnamese would actually bring down the American jets with handguns and rifles. That almost seems unbelievable to us.
From an American standpoint, it is unbelievable in that you only see advanced technology system like a jet fighter bomber needs another advanced technology like a SAM missile in order to bring it down. And there is a lot of some amount of truth in that. But North Vietnam underwent a tremendous social mobilization. Part of that mobilization involved giving almost everyone a gun, either a pistol, a submachine gun, a rifle, or whatever, or light machine guns. The entire society was organized as a giant anti-aircraft system. And for really low level, Vietnamese peasants were under instructions to simply get out in the fields en masse, lie down, and shoot up in the air to try to provide a barrage that would make low altitudes unsafe for American pilots. And it happened. American fighter pilots do report that many planes were shot down at extremely low level by peasants. And what this meant to them, low-level flight became so dangerous they had to move higher up where they could consistently be picked up on radar. In other words, it isn't just that peasants could shoot down planes, it's that they denied an airspace to Americans that made all air operations more hazardous. So social mobilization was able to compensate for technological inferiority.
There was another example of this in the Ho Chi Minh Trail when the United States built that incredibly expensive electronic warfare area, which the Vietnamese and the Laotians were able to overcome with very simple tricks.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff always wanted to invade North Vietnam and simply take over Hanoi and Haiphong or have ground troops in Laos. There is a place where between Laos and Thailand, between the South China Sea and Thailand is something like 35 miles and so wide. So the effort is, the mission was, we'll just form on this magic line and we'll keep the foreign other out, right? We'll stop them at the pass, you know, literally. But since that was seen as too expensive in terms of troop lives, they seeded that area with electronic sensors, listening devices that picked up smell, sensors of various kinds. These devices, in turn, sent radio signals to circling aircraft. The aircraft, in turn, sent them to computer banks in Thailand. In Thailand, in turn, organized airstrikes over the trail. But two things happened. One, the sensors were decoyed. Bags of urine hung in trees, tape recorders with cricket noises. In other words, to try to mask the movement of trucks, you find a sensor and you put just normal jungle noises, a tape of normal jungle noises next to it. So you mask the sensors in one area while you actually send your troops and operations on the other. Or say you get attacked and you were all convoy drivers, truck drivers. North Vietnamese had satchels of grenades. They had rocket flares. A lot of this battle is occurring at night. So the Vietnamese would throw out explosives to make the Americans feel like they were hitting something. And the Americans, in turn, wanted to believe that they were destroying Vietnamese truck convoys. Why? because pilots are rewarded on the basis of productivity. They're majors and lieutenant colonels. Most of them want to be full colonels, and probably some are desperately want to be brigadier generals. They need to be productive. Therefore, their tendency is to report as high a destruction of trucks as possible. And that the big joke eventually became in intelligence was that the next day when reconnaissance flights would fly out along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, they could never find the truck carcasses in anywhere near the numbers that the pilots reported destroyed. So the legend began that deep in the Laotian jungles lived the great truck eater. And the great truck eater was a monster that totally loved dead trucks, and it lives a nocturnal beast, and that every night it got up and it ate Jesus. The skeletons of dead trucks, so that when the reconnaissance planes came out in the morning, there would simply be no records. This is not to say thousands of trucks were destroyed, but never to the extent necessary. Remember, relatively few supplies were sent south. By American calculations, something like 12 tons a day was enough to support the war in the south. You can put 12 tons on a semi-tractor truck without any problem and have room to spare. Or even if you multiply it by figure 15 or 20 fold, say so you have 20 tractor trailer trucks a day on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, or 40 pickups or whatever, that's still such a small number that even a very extensive air war has a hard time or cannot stop that level of supplies.
Bill, most of the military generals and participants in the war whose memoirs you read and documents you studied indicated that the U.S. really won most of the battles of the war, that the U.S. was on its way to victory. And in particular, there's a right-wing revisionist view that the U.S. could have won the war at the time of the Tet Offensive.
At the U.S. buildup of main corps, main force units, ground troops, began in 65. By the end of 67, we had somewhat over 400,000, I think 450,000, maybe even as high as 500,000 troops in country. According to American records, the official records kept in the Pentagon and kept at Military Assistance Command Vietnam, we had just about destroyed all the Viet Cong troops. They were all nearly decimated. Now, why was that? Because our records were falsified.
Right.
As we began, as Tarka talked about last time, once you move into war's production process and the officers are managers, they lose their sense of fidelity to their subordinates below and sense of their fidelity to the truth. Upward mobility, just like in business where man would be going up, you know, up the ladder is the name of the game. That was the ladder in the military. The currency in warfare was to report the body count. So everybody upped their body count. Fake body counts were routine, not the exceptional. And at each level, the body counts kept getting higher and higher. As the reports went up the chain of command, the larger the figures became.
Well, the first report I would send in was from the facts, from the information we collected, and it was objective as it could be. Then we sent it in, but then it would always come back, doctored up from higher headquarters. That was standard operating procedure when I was brigade historian there. So the result is that the battle news was edited and revised until it was acceptable to the higher-ups. Hell, I've been ordered to write open lies on our civil aid program, such as increasing the 15 English classes to 300 to make it look good to the politicians and the people back home. And I've been ordered to raise the figures for food distribution in refugee villages. But I've also had to retype battle reports omitting certain facts and thereby turning a North Vietnam Army victory over superior American forces into a U.S. victory.
So on paper, we had won. But in reality, two things, that was part one of our victory. The second point was, in 1967, the American higher command decided that Viet Cong guerrillas no longer existed because they abolished them on paper. Because just like American forces, we don't have any part-time guerrillas or full-time guerrillas. And also, do guerrillas have 50 to have tanks? Do guerrillas have helicopters? Do guerrillas have heavy artillery? They don't have as much hardware as we do, so they aren't really a threat to American units. So several hundred thousand Viet Cong guerrillas were abolished from what's called the order of battle. So once you eliminate the guerrillas on paper, and then you so you have a lower total estimate of enemy forces, and you have an inflated estimate of how many of those you've killed, well, we'd won. Lyndon Johnson desperately needed a political victory in the fall of 67. So he got General Westmoreland to come back and say, we're winning, that we're soon going to enter into phase three, and that is we're going to mop up for a couple of years. And what was happening in reality? In reality, the Viet Cong forces, the local forces, had expanded radically from 1964 through late 1967. According to U.S. figures, there were only about 200,000 Viet Cong. But when one CIA man started going through the files and trying to refigure things, he calculated about 500,000. And let's understand what that means. If the CIA man is doubling the estimate, that essentially means they don't have any idea of how many of them are there, but it means a double is probably the highest figure he can get away with and still be listened to by anyone. So, in reality, the enemy is gaining strength. We have through the Viet Cong. We have North Vietnamese participation, still around 50,000 troops a year being sent south in the border zones along the Cambodian and Laotian borders and in certain the I Corps, the north of the country. And the U.S. strategic offensive had failed of search and destroy. The bombing operations had failed. In late January, early February 1968, the Viet Cong forces attacked en masse simultaneously for the first time. Normally, they fought very dispersed operations. They were not this was the first time there had been a simultaneous national attack. The attack succeeded in driving, it ended the pacification war. All the units involved in pacification were driven out of the countryside into the cities. Almost all of the Vietnamese and American ground force units were driven out of the countryside back into the cities to defend the cities there. And some Viet Cong forces entered cities, Saigon, Hue, regional capitals, and we began to battle in the cities. Now, what happened? After a few weeks, the Viet Cong withdrew from the cities. Their casualties were extremely high. They had not anticipated that the Americans would bomb and conduct artillery strikes inside the cities, but they did. So a large part of South Vietnam was reduced to rubble. Their casualties were high, but the Americans and South Vietnamese army units were gone from the countryside. Desertions had been massive, and the Viet Cong were able to recruit many, many, many people. Now that there were no opposing forces in the countryside, their political cadres were able to surface. So they were weakened in many ways, but on the other hand, they had achieved a decisive victory in driving their opponents out of the countryside. Now, from what is the legend then, because American forces were able to kill many of the commandos and Viet Cong troops inside the cities, the Americans, General Westmoreland, declared victory. Of course, this ignores the fact that although he's driven the Viet Cong out of the cities, he himself has been driven out of the countryside, and that it's made a mockery out of his own previous claims of victory. Also, it's clear to many, many people that there were far more enemies in South Vietnam than the Americans have been willing to admit. Westmoreland then made a troop request for another 200,000 soldiers. This troop request went under severe analysis. And essentially what was found was that within the production model of war, if you were just going to fight the same kind of warfare but simply add more resources to it, still, the Viet Cong alone, just the people in the South, could fight on for another 4 or 5 years, or at least 3 years to 4 years, and then with any with significant North Vietnamese participation, they could fight on 10 to 20 years. In which we just could not drive the other side bankrupt.
And you're saying that the North Vietnamese Army basically hadn't participated
Not in Tet. The North Vietnamese Army did not participate in Tet.
Okay.
In fact, in most of the war, they really played a minimal role when you consider the number of Viet Cong troops in proportion to the number of North Vietnamese?
Well, groups? That's true up until 68. After 68, okay. They entered the war in larger numbers.
Okay.
The Viet Cong were hit. And it was certainly, the conservative claim that the Viet Cong took severe losses in the Tet Offensive is true. The claim that they were decimated and defeated is false, and the claim that the Americans won Tet is false. Tet essentially helped the American war managers, at least the part of them, see that their strategy was bankrupt and that there was no path to victory.
So this finally created a...
Remember Lyndon Johnson resigned somewhere during this period.
That's right, not too long afterward. Was this kind of a break in their self-delusion that techno-war would win everything?
Ah, now here is a serious problem that people do not understand. American television news began late 1968 on, began to report the idea that the war was winding down and that we were on our way out. This is not true. This is a false statement. You should never believe this. When you look at the casualty figures of how many American soldiers were killed from 65 through 68, through 67, and then you take 68, and then you look 69 through 73, the 69 through 73 is just about, is within a couple of hundred, as high as the number of killed 65 through 67.
So
weak search and destroy continued way, way on until late 71.
So what was it then that finally convinced the U.S. foreign policy establishment or the U.S. public that Vietnam couldn't be won?
From mid-68 on, the American military began to become progressively more restless and by late 69, 70 is in active revolt against its commanders. Remember that 75% of the battles in Vietnam were initiated by the enemy, and the average American grunt spent his tour of duty, those few who were combat troops, spent his tour of duty walking into ambushes. Most men learned fairly quickly that while they were walking into ambushes, that their generals were getting medals and they were safe in helicopters and so on and so forth. So people began what's called fragging. Fragging means you take a fragmentation grenade and you throw it at your superior, whether it's a non-commissioned officer sergeant or a lieutenant or a captain or whatever. It was a way to tell higher command not to treat the ground troops' lives frivolously, that they would not aggressively pursue dangerous combat situations, that simply in order to make the superiors look good.
Well, let me tell you how it worked. We'd start having war calls, which is like, at midnight, everybody in the outfit starts opening fire and screaming, "Gooks on the wire, gooks on the wire," in the barbed wire fences, you know. And then you'd try to kill any of the lifers that you didn't like. So we tried to get the CO a couple of times with the machine gun. One time his rack took 9 holes, his cot 9 bullet holes, but he dove out of it and got away. Everybody'd be shooting, so he couldn't check the weapon, see who was shooting him. So they'd be throwing grenades at the wire and yelling and shouting, "Gooks on the wire, gooks," and they'd blow the siren and then run around, and half the guys would be facing out where it's shooting, and then the other half would be waiting for a lifer to come out of his tent.
Yeah, I've seen whole officers executed 5 or 6 times. Just put a price on his head. Next one that kills him gets the money. Next time he was out on a mission, everybody knew it was going to happen. They just wait till he was in the right position.
And the estimates run quite high. And there was, the official Army count is about 650 fragging incidents. And there are real reasons to doubt that. Because
have been quite small. I'm sure there were a lot of them that weren't reported.
Oh, of course, because no commander wants to have, what do you say, it's like some of my own men threw a grenade at me or tried to shoot me. I mean, how is that going to look good on your record? Are you going to get promoted up as a great leader when you're reporting that your own people are shooting at you? No, I'm sure the records are, the figures must be substantially higher.
The soldiers even put pools of money out for contracts for particularly unpopular officers.
But there was also suicide and self-mutilation that went on, too.
People got desperate. They were disoriented. They were not being cared for by their own command. The actual operations often involved slaughter of innocents. Suicide rates are fairly high. Standing up in the middle of a firefight. There's one famous cartoon book by a man named Tad Forrester. And It shows a picture of a man, of a soldier hiding behind a rock with his trigger finger in the air looking for the million-dollar wound. The theory being, like, if he exposed this and got his index finger shot off, that he could get out of the war zone. Or you don't take your malaria pill. You're going to get, therefore, removed because you're incapacitated with malaria. There were many, many ways of were people shooting themselves in the foot. There are lots and lots of stories of self-mutilation. Or you do it to your friend. In other words, if your friend has, say, been wounded twice and you're on a particularly dangerous mission and he's had a premonition of death, which was taken very, very seriously, all combat soldiers are deeply superstitious, then sometimes you shoot or you stab your friend, not in a vital place, but to wound them enough to get them out. You can't fight a war this way. You cannot fight a war where people are you going searching a void?
Also, yeah, search and avoid. That was a very prevalent thing too. Instead of search and destroy, search and avoid.
That is, you go out and you play war. You try to go out and smoke some dope or and you fake some radio reports or you generally try not to engage the enemy. Yes.
We talked about it every day. All the guys felt the same way. We just weren't accomplishing anything. In fact, some guys were so depressed and disgusted they was killing themselves. Some guys were taking hand grenades and blowing themselves away. They couldn't take the strain anymore. God, it's really heavy. I don't think a lot of this stuff was reported. GIs would just kill themselves. In the Army, you'd probably send the stats home that the guy was killed or missing in action.
And did the anti-war movement at home have any effect on these soldiers in creating a sense of what they were doing was wrong, that they were victims, they were making mistakes? Did that have impact, do you think, on the soldiers?
There was a wide GI coffee house movement. The anti-war movement tried to set up coffee houses near U.S. bases to promote literature and things. But honestly, when you read soldiers' memoirs and novels, they honestly don't talk about the anti-war movement very much. It's not to say there wasn't an influence, but they talk about reacting to the situation of warfare that they're in. The one the moral qualms are the moral qualms that are seen on the battlefield. The one clear influence of the anti-war movement is nobody wanted to be the last man to die in Vietnam. I mean, once it was stated that the U.S. was going to withdraw eventually, that made it more difficult.
There was one place in your book where you said that this actually was a class warfare that was going on, and that black soldiers were at the forefront of the fragging and the revolt.
Let's remember who went to Vietnam. After World War II, the U.S. military decided that too many college-educated men had been killed, and that the danger of this was that it was going to hurt the scientific base of the country. If the scientific base of the country was hurt, we couldn't have the next generation of weapons. So the idea of the 2S deferment, of the college deferment, was to keep the pool alive. What this meant was, remember, this is an era of very few student loans, very few scholarships, so on and so forth. It meant that the sons of the middle class could go to college, where the sons of the working class went to the military. In the military itself, military needs vast numbers of white-collar skills. So if you had any kind of clerical skills, like middle-class people often do, typing, filing, so on, you could more readily get a non-combat job. What this translated into is that once you started, got down to the point of who was in your infantry units, your armor and artillery, they were overwhelmed. They were disproportionately minorities and rural whites, poor rural whites, poor urban whites. So we had a working class, largely working class military, combat military, whereas a more middle class anti-war movement and a more middle class logistic apparatus in the military.
So it was a class revolt.
A class revolt. No, I wouldn't call it a revolution. We're not talking about these people. We're not socialists now. But it is sort of like let's revolt against the manager, yes.
It's not in our interest. They're exploiting and using us.
Yes. Yeah, and it's certainly with among black soldiers that they were definitely influenced by the Black Power movement. Racial consciousness and critical consciousness was very paramount, and there were many of the tie signs, of bonding signs, of, you know, the skin and special handshake, so on and so forth.
How would you evaluate the mass media handling of Vietnam then and now?
I spent a long time looking at the tapes, and I was close. It's like I'd finished my outline and was going to write a book about television news coverage of the war, and I decided to think, well, what was not on the news frame? What I saw, and that's consequently I wrote this other book, The Perfect War. What's on the news is a lot of pictures of helicopters, a lot of pictures of jets, a lot of pictures of tanks, a lot of hardware. In other words, techno-war was the major representation, too, visual representation. And along with these presentations of these beautiful weapons, I remember my favorite was an ABC show, an ABC series, where they first went out and they see the battleship New Jersey. Battleship New Jersey had just been recommissioned in 69, and we see here's this 16-inch guns, and there's this giant 30-foot phallus that the camera looks down, and the guy starts talking about it, shoots a 250-pound projectile 16 miles, it'll go through 32 feet of reinforced concrete, or maybe I have it the other way, maybe it's 32 miles, 16 feet of reinforced concrete, I forget, and it's a 250-yard kill radius, and it's simply, like the man is, the correspondent become a salesperson. And, like, I thought, gosh, I, too, want the battleship New Jersey, you know. This is just cool beyond belief. And then the film cuts, and there's another correspondent, and he's on the bank of a river, and it's about the VC flying trash can. And did you remember the Roadrunner rockets, you know, about Wile E. Coyote was always getting something from Acme Rocket Company that always kind of looked like a trash can on a stick with a kind of, like, triangle on top of it? That's exactly what this rocket looked like. It was obviously of a homemade, crude rocket. And the contrast is so great, and it seems like American victory is so insured because we're of our technical superiority. Of course, what they don't point out, the Viet Cong who fires that rocket knows exactly what he's shooting at, was the battleship New Jersey very rarely knew where its bullets were flying.
So the
that's what the people saw. People saw that. People did not see very many dead people. There were very few. The death convention on the news was much like a war movie or westerns. No real gore. And they saw a body count each week, which showed that we were always winning. We saw one village. One village was burned in 1965. That's it. And the guy correspondent got in severe trouble. May Lie appeared, as remembered, did not come from, the news of it didn't come from the normal networks. It came from a veteran who tried hard to get the news out. Very little coverage of mass hysteria came on. The ordinary language of the war, gook, slope, slant, dink, no American news correspondent ever talked about those terms and what they meant. Never. It simply did not occur. Instead, it was very much an official perspective. Where one got critical, from 68 on, occasionally you would see reports about failed technology, and occasionally you would see stories about tragic American deaths. But it was sort of like a human interest tragedy becomes the limit of criticism rather than any kind of explanatory notion of why we aren't succeeding.
Bill, let's talk about an evaluation of the Vietnam War. A lot of people have written books about it, historians and generals, et cetera.
Well, let's end it just to come back to where we started, to this other point. My analysis says the U.S. had to get out because we couldn't fight, because we had an army that wouldn't do it anymore. Now, you could move to Air Force campaigns, but Air Force campaigns have their problems, too. You can't hold ground with airplanes. Sending money to the South Vietnamese, they were corrupt. They just had more money to be corrupt with. So we were defeated. My analysis says the United States was defeated, and that's the standpoint. So the question is, how have the historians and the novelists and so on treated the subject of American defeat? The conventional path is a liberal interpretation. That is, it's just a tragedy. It's just things were wrong out there somewhere, and like it's just like there were all sorts of small mistakes of honorable men making small decisions.
Arthur Schlesinger
would be the most famous, the classical case. Stanley Carnell's book and PBS series, the most recent example. But the notion of tragedy is not an explanation. You know, 20 years of small mistakes doesn't explain a war that has a very clear structure, which is my argument, and if the structural contradictions of that mode of warfare ended in its dissolution and in failure. The second school, the prominent right now, is that U.S. lost because of self-imposed restraints. Self-imposed restraints is a military term often used in Joint Chiefs of Staff documents calling for escalated air war. And their vision is that the United States should have invaded North Vietnam in 1966 and taken Hanoi and Haiphong. Of course, the only problem with that, every one of those peasants who had those guns shooting against the aircraft, the jet fighter pilots, they were also organized and prepared for an invasion. And Doug, you mentioned the fact that the North Vietnamese didn't have very many troops in the South. That was one of the major reasons. It wasn't that they didn't want to help their comrades and their southern comrades. it was troops were being held back in part to protect the home front against a possible American invasion. According to GIAP, the plan for to fight a U.S. invasion was to let local militia and regional forces fight for the first day to 2 days. So once the Americans were tired, after 24 to 48 hours of constant combat, then the North Vietnamese army would enter the scene. And this notion that the U.S. could have had a successful invasion is just the most bizarre, unreal fantasy, unworthy of any kind of serious consideration. And even if they had put an expeditionary force in Hanoi and Haiphong, that wouldn't change the class structure in South Vietnam. That wouldn't change the fact that you had a peasantry that wanted land, that you wanted Buddhists who wanted self-determination rather than Catholic rule, and that you wanted that a whole country wanted national reunification because the whole basis of the culture was throwing out the foreign invader, and that's all they'd done all their lives for 2,000 years was throw out the Chinese, the French, and now the Americans. It wouldn't have changed it. The self-imposed restraint still is false.
Well, have we learned anything since then? You point out the total corruption and self-delusion of the military and the civilian leaders throughout this. First of all, thinking they could wage a techno war, and secondly, not paying attention to the realities which might try to seep up from the intelligence field, suppressing any intelligence that would contrary to what they wanted. Are we still in that same mode of thinking?
Yes.
And are we thinking of applying it to?
Well, we already have a couple of places. Certainly, Grenada was one example. We took Grenada. And we just barely took it, even though there was a minimum opposition. Most of the U.S. Special Forces commandos bit the dust in various operations because of the various mishaps of one kind or another. Also, the military's analysis is, well, not only did we fight with one hand tied behind our back, but we fought too slow. We needed more rapid escalation. So Honduras has been prepared. A series of airfields and ports had been prepared in Honduras in order to bring 40, 50,000 troops into battle within a week. They have the facilities for this. And they still have, many of the military have the delusion that they could probably take Managua and a few other places in a couple of weeks, rather than an extensive Central American war, which would escalate tremendously, because the Nicaraguans have no choice except to expand the war outside of Nicaragua to make the battlefield bigger. If the battlefield's bigger, then the United States has to disperse its troops. If its troops are dispersed, can't achieve victory.
Back to Vietnam.
Sounds like they haven't learned a thing.
They have not learned a thing. But then most haven't learned a thing. There are veterans, of course, in the U.S. who certainly don't want to see this. There are probably parts of the military in very subordinate positions who don't want to see a major escalation. But generally we're on track for another kind of major intervention, whether or not it will be, since the Iran-Agua crisis has emerged, that may be off for a while. I don't know. But there's certainly Philippines. There's another growing insurgency there. The chances for another major intervention and another series of self-delusions are very, very high, because the officer corps who were successful in Vietnam are the people who are in charge now. The people who were the dissidents, the few handfuls of lieutenant colonels and majors who just got repulsed, they got out. They resigned. Most of them did.
Ironically, the Army itself recognized this in 1970 in a War College study, which indicated that there is a significant difference between the ideal Army values such as honesty, integrity, bravery, justice, and responsibility, and the real values which are practiced by the military in order to promote career advancement. Here is the study's conclusion. The present climate does not appear to be self-correcting. The human drives for success and recognition by seniors, sustained if not inflamed by the system of rewards and management which cater to immediate personal success at the expense of moral and ethical values, would appear to only be perpetuated by the current environment. The fact alone that the leaders of the future are those who survived and excelled within the rules of the present system militates in part against any self-starting incremental return toward the practical application of ideal Army values.
And then the final reason I note the problem of learning is that there are cultural reasons that make the American people want to believe the self-imposed restraint school. And that is, we are used to the tradition of the cowboy who comes in and saves a society against the enemies when the power structure cannot defend itself. The idea of a weak authority that has to be saved by a warrior shows up in many places in American culture. In the Western, in the detective hero is outside the law. All the Superman and the Masked Avenger figures of the 20s and 30s certainly are able to foil criminals that legal authorities cannot.
But also, isn't there a deep belief that technology cannot fail
certainly
in American culture, that if we have enough technological or military force, we can't help but win a war?
It's hard not to believe in your hardware. Americans don't learn about social relations. They don't learn about class structure every day in the newspaper or about cultural history every day in the newspaper. They learn about what's for sale.
Then what is the lesson of Vietnam concerning the limits of techno-war, the situations in which
techno-war can destroy, but it cannot achieve victory. It can destroy land, it can destroy people, but it can't create a government, it can't create a culture, it can't create a society.
I mean, this was another thing we tried to do in Vietnam, to impose the model of the consumer society on them and American-style supposed democracy, where there'd be elections, in situations where these just couldn't work.
Oh, well, it did work in a way. In other words, yeah, people can become corrupted. They did get into their drugs and their Hondas and things, but it just doesn't build a stable society. It doesn't build... It doesn't build people who are willing to die for that society. That was the whole problem they had. You had plenty of corrupted Vietnamese, but when it looks like things were near, they weren't willing to go out and defend Saigon to the death or not. They just did. They bought their tickets out to the United States.
Whereas the peasants were willing to fight to death just for land.
Yes.
And just for getting rid of their landlords or local oppressors.
Yes.
It made perfect sense to them.
And there's been this problem, the so-called Vietnam syndrome, which our leaders have been complaining about all these years. As if there was a sickness in the land. The Americans,
a loss of will to fight, yes.
But it looks like the American public had a clearer picture of what the war was all about than the leaders. But how would you assess that, and do you think that they were overcoming that Vietnam syndrome now so that they can...
Well, I don't think the American public ever had an idea what was wrong. They just knew something was wrong and that it wasn't getting better. In fact, I think indeed their fuzziness made it easier for people to believe the self-imposed restraint school, to believe that we lost because we didn't fight hard enough. For the past few years, popular culture has presented the hero, the warrior imagery as well, very much strong on the rise. We've had many classical war movies made and several kind of variant war movies made. It's definitely a war culture. How people, though... Clearly, though, there's still a resistance. There's still a certain level in which the disaster of Vietnam is etched in at least some people's memories. And even though they don't have an understanding of why it failed or what the structural reasons, there is a fear that it will happen again.
In Bill Gibson's book, The Perfect War, he quotes Tim O'Brien's novel, Going After Cacciato, about the difficulty of determining reality for Americans in Vietnam. Here's what he said. They did not know even the simple things, a sense of victory or satisfaction or necessary sacrifice. They didn't know the feeling of taking a place and keeping it, or securing a village and then raising the flag and calling it a victory. No sense of order or momentum, no front, no rear, no trenches laid out in neat parallels, no Patton rushing for the Rhine, no beachheads to storm and win and hold for the duration. They didn't have targets. They didn't have a cause. They didn't know if it was a war of ideology or economics or hegemony or spite. On a given day, they didn't even know where they were. They didn't know the terms of war, its architecture, the rules of fair play. When they took prisoners, which was rare, they didn't know how to question or to ask or whether to release a suspect or to beat on him. They didn't know how to feel. Whether seeing a dead Vietnamese to be happy or sad or relieved. And whether in times of quiet to be apprehensive or content. Whether to engage the enemy or elude him. They didn't know how to feel when they saw villages burning. Revenge, loss, peace of mind, or anguish. They didn't know. All these uncertainties never articulated in war stories. Emotion squandered on ignorance. They did not know good from evil.
An appropriately somber and thoughtful note on which to end the show this week. And if you'd like to hear more first-hand testimony from soldiers on the ground recounting their experiences of the Vietnam War, you could look, for example, at Unwelcome Guests episodes 402 to 404, which also makes the parallel between the modern-day American wars for profit, such as those in Iraq and Afghanistan. All previous episodes of the show are available for download online from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. And special thanks this time go out to Skip Gap for pointing me to the material. If you find any material which you think is worthy for the show, or if you'd just like to suggest a topic, don't hesitate to email me. My email address is unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Climate scientist Kevin Anderson on the unforgiving math for staying under 2 degrees. Much was made of the April 22, 2016 signing of the climate treaty negotiated in Paris last December. At the ceremony in New York, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said that we are in a race against time, and that the window for the goals set in Paris for keeping global temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius, let alone 1.5 degrees, is rapidly closing. During the negotiations in Paris in December 2015, some scientists had already warned that even a 2 degrees Celsius limit in temperature would be almost impossible to maintain unless we were to make significant changes within the next 5 years. Kevin Anderson is one extraordinary and important voice among them. Anderson is professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester. He has recently finished a 2-year position as director of the Tyndall Centre, the UK's leading academic climate change research organization. Anderson grew up next door to a nuclear power station where his father worked. Before getting his PhD, Anderson became an engineer, apprenticing on ships. He later worked in the oil industry and on drilling platforms. From 1990 on, he dedicated his life to understanding and publishing about climate change. Anderson was interviewed in Paris during the COP21 conference by Kevin Caners, radio producer with his blog, The Elephant. I found his informative and thought-provoking interview online and asked and received permission to rebroadcast. Caners' blog, The Elephant, focuses on the threat to our planet by human-induced climate change. Caners sees this challenge as interwoven with every aspect of our societies, our lives, and our civilization. Caners attended the Paris negotiations of December 2015 and observed how 195 countries agreed that they would keep average global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. But he asked himself what science has to say on actually keeping those goals. And how fast and by how much will we have to cut our emissions to get there? Caners says he chose to interview Kevin Anderson because that is exactly the area Anderson works in. He met up with him in the hallway of one of the assembly centers in Paris in December 2015. Here's Caners introducing his interview of Professor Anderson.
Kevin takes what we know from climate science and applies knowledge from other fields, like engineering and policy. He does this to map out various scenarios or emissions curves that would allow us to stay within our carbon budget and have a high probability of meeting the goals we've set. And I'm afraid he doesn't have good news for us. You see, the thing is, we've waited a really long time.
All of your life, people of my generation have chosen to do absolutely nothing about climate change. A quarter of a century. Worse than doing nothing, we've actually watched the emissions go up.
In fact, we've waited so long that despite what we agreed to in Paris, the window for us to actually be able to meet 2 degrees is extremely tight. And that window is closing quickly. So quickly that many scientists wonder if we can meet it at all. Kevin points out that climate change isn't about 2100 or the next 50 years. Because not only has it already arrived, due to the carbon budget we have left, it's really the next 5 years that will determine what kind of world we're left with for generations to come. One of the primary things you do is you look at the official targets, like 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, yeah. and then sort of reverse engineer it and say, well, what would that mean to get there? Can you just describe a bit about what that work involves?
Yes, I mean, let's just take the 2°C target. We have a 2°C, and I firstly don't like calling it a target. I see it's an obligation or a duty. If you look at the language that was wrapped around it, it was never about a target. It was, we will take the action. Not we may take the action, we'll try and take the action. It's we will take the action to keep the temperature below 2°C. So let's be clear, the 2°C framing is not something that scientists derive. It is something that came out of civil society. Science informs that debate. Science can tell you what the impacts might be at certain temperatures in certain parts of the world. That sort of thing. But whether that set of impacts are seen to be dangerous or not is the role of civil society and the sort of messy process of international negotiations. And unfortunately, that messy process has been dominated, if we're blunt about it, by rich, white, generally men in the Northern Hemisphere. And we now have this target of 2°C. And what we're hearing here in Paris is that there are many people around the world who think we should go for a lower target of 1.5. And they have a very legitimate case for that. Nevertheless, we have this agreement around 2°C, even though, as I say, it's 2°C is likely to be dangerous and deadly for many of poor communities. It's then the role of people like me to take that and say, well, what does science tell us about 2°C, what we'd need to deliver in terms of emission reductions? Now, the science tells us very clearly, and particularly the latest IPCC report, that for a temperature rise across the century, we have a set carbon budget. total amount of carbon dioxide that we can emit into the atmosphere. And then we can, quite easily as scientists, we can start to translate to what does that mean in terms of the mitigation rates, how fast we have to reduce our emissions. We know what the current level of emissions are. We might make some assumptions about emissions from, say, deforestation or from cement use, so we can then work out what's the emissions from energy, the bit I focus on. So we might make certain sets of assumptions, but they can be very clear and obvious assumptions. You can adjust those a little bit up and down. But in the end of the day, we have a very clear carbon budget, and if ever you adjust these bits of detail, the same message comes out. We need rapid and deep reductions, probably bordering on the 10% per annum level.
Yeah. Let me pick back up on that in a second, but first, let me get this idea of the carbon budget straight. So basically, we can calculate more or less how much carbon we can collectively burn until we definitely go over that 2-degree line?
Yes, yes. I mean, there's a bit more to it than that, but yes. If we're talking about stabilizing atmospheric temperature of a 2-degree C rise by the end of the century, we have a set of carbon budgets. Now, they vary a bit with the probability. Do you want a very good chance of it? So it's not really a very good chance, but the best that we're using is a 66% chance of staying below 2 degrees C, or do you want a 50-50 chance, or just a 30% chance of staying below 2 degrees C? And they all have a different carbon budget associated with them. And that is the total amount of carbon dioxide we can emit into the atmosphere between 2011 and 2100. That's the budget range they've given in the IPCC report. And we understand that fairly clearly, and there is a very high correlation between temperature and the total amount of CO2 we put in the atmosphere.
So when you crunch the numbers and kind of look at the carbon budget that would keep us below this threshold, what do you come away with?
Okay, well, firstly, there's very little of the carbon budget left. We are in now 2015, with the end of 2015, and the carbon budgets in the IPCC report are from 2011. So we've already emitted, since 2011, 150 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere. Now, that's 15% of the budget for a good chance of 2 degrees C. Gone. So you already say, well, that's already spent. You know, that, if you imagine it like a bank balance, that £15 out of your £100 in the bank has now gone.
And how much carbon are we burning a year right now?
About 36, 37, something like that, billion tonnes of carbon dioxide. So the current rate, it would take about under 20 years. At current consumption rates, it would be under 20 years. And then the budget would have gone completely. We can also then look at who are the people, you know, burning that carbon dioxide. And we can understand that either from a country level, which I understand it with a reasonable level, or a very good level of detail. So how much of it is in the EU or the US or China or Tanzania or whatever it might be. So we understand that fairly well. Or the recent, some very recent work that's been done by Chancel and Piketty, which actually says, and also a report from Oxfam whilst we've been here, says, well, but who does it come from? And they show that 50% of the emissions come from 10% of the population. They show that the top 1% of emitters in the US have emissions that are 2,500 times higher than the bottom 1% globally. So you can then start to say, well, it's not just about national boundaries, it's actually about the people who are high emitters, and we can identify who they are quite well. So, you know, looking at those sorts of things can help you understand what the policies would have to be, either at a national level or beyond that, to think about how do you develop policies that focus particularly on these high emitting people. So that's the sort of work that I'm involved with.
So it sounds like that involves a lot of thinking about power then.
It does. I mean, even if you only think about it from a mathematical sense, you can say, here's a particular group who have very high emissions. And if their emissions are so high, you think, well, it doesn't matter about the rest of the population. This is the group that really matters. Then, you know, that they are ambitions of power, that they are very influential people is almost separate. If you're serious about 2 degrees centigrade, I can sort of say, well, if 2 degrees C has to be achieved, have a certain carbon budget, these people are responsible for the lion's share of that carbon budget. I have to say that we have to come up with mechanisms that will bring the emissions down from that particular group. So if you like, the maths forces you into questioning these issues of power. And it may well be that these particular groups, it is the case, that these particular groups will respond to certain types of policies differently to how other groups may respond, which is one of the reasons I'm not a great advocate of a simple carbon price.
Because?
Because at least the way that most people have thought about carbon prices, if you put a carbon price on energy, the price of energy goes up. But people like me and the high emitters are inelastic to the price of energy. If our flights go up the price by 25%, so what? We still fly. If our car fuel goes up by 25%, we just drive the same large cars. We don't significantly change what we do. Price of carbon goes up. That means the price of fertilizer goes up, because that takes a lot of energy to make fertilizer. That means the price of food goes up, which means the poor people can buy less food. The price of energy goes up. 20% of all houses in the UK are in fuel poverty. That means they cannot heat their houses adequately in the winter. So there's a real equity implication of price. We have to certainly have to think beyond a simple, let's just add a carbon price, and that would be enough. It will be very inequitable. And actually, I don't think it will really drive the emissions down very significantly in terms of behaviour and so forth. It may help us move our energy systems from, say, coal towards gas, or if the price was high enough, maybe, you know, towards renewables. It would have to be a very high carbon price. But then you sort of say, well, that has these other impacts elsewhere. And that's why I'm saying the policies need to be much more subtle and nuanced than a simple carbon tax.
Well, we talked to James Hansen the other night, and he was talking very specifically about doing a revenue-neutral carbon tax.
Yeah. I think, actually, oddly enough, although I've really been quite opposed to a price mechanism for a long time, including emissions trading, I don't particularly like. Nevertheless, I think the idea popularized by Hansen, I don't think it was his originally, but I mean that idea of fee and dividend, it's when you initially look at it, it's quite attractive. The idea that if you consume more energy and therefore emit more carbon, that you would pay a large sum of money for that, and then that money is distributed out evenly across all of society, helps overcome some of the equity implications of a high carbon price. There is the practical part about, can you imagine applying that globally? Could you imagine the US saying we're happy to see huge amounts of money going to Ghana or Nigeria or wherever else it would be? So I think at a global level it becomes quite challenging to know how you apply that.
But at a national level?
I would like to think you could imagine it being applied at national level. I'd be interested to know whether in the States that would be the case. You can imagine, you know, the Republicans or indeed, you know, the Democrats as well. These would be that very high emitting group. And if they're serious about 2 degrees C, the carbon price would be huge. It wouldn't just be $10, $20, $50. I would think if we're serious about 2 degrees C carbon budgets, that carbon price would have to be in the hundreds and hundreds of dollars to meet the carbon budgets that we have. And remember, it's the policymakers who would have to pay that very high carbon tax who would have to pass it as well, because they're the ones that are going to be the high emitting group.
What would you say to people who say that, you know, 2 degrees of global temperature rise, that doesn't actually sound like that much?
Well, coming from the northwest of the UK, 2 degrees C sounds quite pleasant. We'd like a bit of warming, really. But then you start to think, well, but what does it really mean globally? It is a very significant temperature increase. 2 degrees C is a global average. That's about 6 degrees in the poles. So that means we will melt the Arctic for a considerable period of the year. So it's a huge temperature rise. But also, we don't live in global averages. We live in weather. We don't live in climate. We live in weather. And you have to then ask, well, what would these global averages of 2 degrees C mean for the extreme weather events? They're the ones that cause us real problems. When we see extreme weather, there would be a climate signal on top of that. And you start to think, well, that would be a considerable additional flooding in some parts of the world, droughts, prolonged heat waves, changes in food patterns, changes in rainfall around the planet. And we all have learned to live with our current climate. Our infrastructures have evolved. You look at somewhere like a lot of Europe, not continental Europe particularly, the infrastructures have evolved over hundreds of years of a particular form of climate. And so when that climate changes and when you start to get these extreme weather events, our infrastructures have not been developed for that. And that's not just our technical infrastructures, but our social infrastructures, like our agricultural framing and all of that sort of thing. So actually, 2 degrees C is not this, you know, on a cold day in Manchester, sounds quite pleasant. It's nothing like that. I mean, it is a fundamental change in the shape of our planet in many respects. If you head to something like 4 degrees C, it's almost like another planet. I mean, it's living somewhere that looks very different and feels very different from the world in which we live. And also, we have to be careful that the 2 degrees C, the Northern Hemisphere, we like to think that we can, you know, think that we can probably just buy our way out of it. Now, I still think many of the poorer people in the Northern Hemisphere will still struggle at 2 degrees C. We'll certainly struggle a lot at 2 degrees C. But the poorer people in the climatically vulnerable parts of the world, 30 million people living on the coastal strip of Bangladesh within a metre of sea level rise and already susceptible to typhoons that will increase in severity and possibly frequency with increased climate change, their lives are going to be made even more unbearable. So people who are already struggling with the current climate are going to find their lives much more challenged. Yeah, and let's be really clear and blunt about this. Many millions of people will die if we don't do something about climate change. You know, 2, 3, 4 degrees C, we are talking about millions and millions of people, possibly billions of people being affected. You know, we have to accept the fact that many people will suffer the implications of this and are already suffering the implications of just a 1 degree temperature rise.
1 degree is what we have so far?
1 degree is about the warming that we've seen so far, yes.
So if we're talking about millions, potentially billions of people being affected, why do you think we've responded collectively with mostly a shrug?
Because we're not prepared to question our current economic and political paradigm. You know, we have this particular way of viewing the world, and that has become so dominant. It's more important than physics and maths. So, you know, it's almost like, you know, set down by God, this is how the world has to be, and you must not question it. And the scientists feel constrained by the fact that they feel they can't really question this, so they were always trying to fine-tune certain sets of assumptions to make sure it delivers within the current political paradigm. Our policymakers like it because it means they haven't got to put forward, you know, very stringent policies. We like it as a scientific community because we can carry on flying to our nice climate change conferences all around the world. The public like it because they can carry on going on their holidays and buy their cars and not have to worry about this sort of agenda. You know, when we think about carbon, it's in every facet of our life. It's in the dyes that make up my coat here. It's how we travel to this event here. It's in the varnish that's on the seats that we're sat on now. Every part of our life has been influenced by carbon, fossil fuel-based carbon. And we're talking about trying to take that out of the system in 20, 30, 40 years, at the very outside, maybe 20, 30 years. This is a huge challenge. We've never faced anything like that, let alone faced it when you've got 7 billion people on the planet. And you put all of that together, you know, tie that in with our current economic paradigm. No one really wants to stand up and say, I'll start to show some leadership on this. I'll start to, you know, make the sorts of changes that are necessary. And even the NGOs are being co-opted, really, in this. You know, much of the time, they're all part of the same quite upbeat, optimistic view that technology in the future will solve the problem for us. And as an engineer, I really wish that was the case. You know, I spent a lot of my life working on large pieces of engineering equipment, designing and constructing them. And I wish we could simply engineer our way out of this problem. Engineering is an important part of getting out of this problem, but it is nowhere near enough. It has huge social, political, moral and philosophical repercussions now.
Geoengineering, you mean?
Simply engineering in terms of things like renewable energy. I mean, that's a big engineering task. You know, if you think, you know, nuclear power is very low, it has lots of other problems with it, but, you know, again, that's a big engineering task. Engineering low-carbon transport networks, improving rail networks, building houses that are very low energy consumption or zero energy consumption, hopefully even generate energy. All of this is engineering that we should be doing. I wasn't particularly thinking about geoengineering or negative emission technologies. I think they're part of the problem. People think we can do all of this engineering very quickly. I was in an event today and someone was saying, well, we can just do it all with renewable power. I'm all for renewable power. But just be realistic. We cannot build enough renewable power to get us off the curve or down to the curve that would be necessary for 2 degrees centigrade. We just can't physically do that. And therefore, in the interim, because we've left it so late, we have to reduce our levels of energy demand. The wealthy of us have to make very significant reductions. If we started this in 1990, when the first IPCC report came out, a quarter of a century ago, I don't know how old you are, but you were probably very young a quarter of a century ago, we've had all of that time to do something about it. So virtually all of your life, people like my generation have chosen to do absolutely nothing about climate change. A quarter of a century. Worse than doing nothing, we've actually watched the emissions go up. So this year, the emissions will be 60% higher than they were a quarter of a century ago. That shows how much we've cared about climate change.
So you mean even if we were to take all the policies that people would be advocating with building renewables and putting in a high carbon tax or whatever, even then we couldn't reduce it fast enough, you don't think, just with building solar and wind?
No, nowhere near fast enough. No.
Just because of the lag time?
Yeah, because of the lag time. But don't we just think, solar and wind, great. Both, I'm really for solar and wind, and they're wonderful technologies. Their price is really coming down. How do you fly your planes with those? Are you going to power all your ships traveling around the world with solar and wind? How about all the car infrastructure? Is that going to go overnight to solar and wind? You know, electricity is 20% of the energy we consume. 80% of the energy we consume is not electricity. Now, fine, we can convert a lot of that to electric and then make it more renewable. But that's not a five-minute job, building a grid network that is 3, 4, 5 times bigger than one we have today that can deal with some of the intermittency issues, which have been exaggerated by some people. But nevertheless, there's a different performance structure to performance output from renewable-type power to the sort of typical thermal power stations we've been more used to.
So what makes up the other 80% then? Transportation mostly, or what?
Oh, well, gas for heating, transportation, our aircraft, our ships. Industry requires lots of direct energy use. You know, there's gas, sometimes coal. Sometimes oil. So that's 80% of the energy is not electricity. And I think most people forget that. And a lot of the NGOs forget that. And they talk about energy and electricity as if they're the same thing. They both begin in E and end in Y, but they're quite different. Now, we can electrify a lot of the other part of the system, but that is not a five-minute job. You know, that is going to take us quite a lot of years to do that. And even if we had, as I often call it, a Marshall-style plan, which is like the reconstruction after the Second World War, if we were that concerned about climate change and we really put all of our efforts into constructing a low-carbon physical infrastructure, that will still take us too long for the carbon budgets that we have left. So it is a prerequisite. We have to do that, but we also, therefore, have to reduce our energy consumption in the short term. And whilst we reduce our energy consumption, and that energy is primarily fossil fuel, we will reduce our carbon dioxide emissions.
So you're saying there's a huge cognitive dissonance, even among people who are really involved with this issue?
Oh, yes. I mean, I often use that in my slides, this idea of a cognitive dissonance, or I say a fancy academic term for hypocrisy a lot of the time. There's many of us actually aware of this. But having said that, many people also are not. I mean, a lot of climate scientists work in their particular area of climate science. They're not experts in the broader issues of mitigation or the broader issues of climate change. and they make quite often naive assumptions about the world outside.
What are those naive assumptions about the world outside?
Well, often about how fast you can put technologies in place. So a lot of scientists I engage with, really, I get the impression that they've never really done any engineering. They've never been involved in any building anything. It takes a long time to build something. And you don't just do it one power station or two power stations or 30 power stations or one or two new train lines. You're doing it across the full swathe of infrastructure, trying to convert it all to low carbon in 20 to 30 years. Now, that is a Herculean engineering task. So we can use carbon capture and storage. We can use, you know, all of these other renewable technologies. They take a long time to put in place. Solar is interesting, and it's been put out much quicker than anyone expected, and it's much cheaper. And I'm not saying we can't do things much quicker, and I'm very much in favour of us shifting towards renewables like there's no tomorrow. All I'm simply saying is, even when we do the best we could possibly imagine, it's nowhere near enough to get us to the 2 degree C carbon budget. And if we're serious about 2 degree C, therefore in the interim we have to reduce our energy consumption. It can go back up again when we have low carbon energy supply. We can go back to all of the inequalities and all the other things that we have in our lives if we think that's really worth having. Imagine a car with five seats having more than one person in it. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine when you look at Europe nowadays or the US. You have a big car, there's only ever one person in it. We have to find some way out of this, that we start to learn to be more, not necessarily more communal, but at least more aware of the energy we use when we try and do something. At the moment, when you think about when we travel short distances, what do? We get 90 kilograms, in my case, 93 kilograms of flesh. You get in a car that weighs 1,500 kilograms, and you drive 7 kilometres to pick up some groceries. You know, in 2015, can we not find a better way to pick up 10 kilograms of groceries than having to transport 1,500 kilograms of metal to a supermarket and then bring it back again?
But if that's necessary right now, we have a pretty big gap there from what is politically even anywhere feasible and what you're saying is necessary that we do right this minute.
I don't think we're going to succeed at this. I mean, we cannot guarantee we will fail because we haven't tried. If we tried, we may well find that we don't succeed. But if we don't try, we're guaranteed to fail. If we are serious about 2 degrees centigrade, we have to acknowledge that and say we are going to deal with it. Otherwise, let's be honest and say we're not going to aim for 2, we're aim for 3 or 4, and just tell the poor people elsewhere in the world, well, forget it, we're not worried about your future. Let's just be honest about that. That's really the underlying text from Paris. We don't really care about the poor and vulnerable elsewhere. So the real message coming out of something like this is the wealthy parts of the world who are responsible for the lion's share of the emissions, or even the wealthier within the poorer parts of the world as well. We just don't care about the people who are going to be impacted by climate change. That's the real take-home message.
That's a level of honesty that it also doesn't seem very feasible.
Well, it is a level of honesty. I mean, okay, so what we're always saying then is that we can only carry on by being dishonest. I mean, I think humanity can be more than that. I think humanity can be honest. I think humanity can make very significant changes. I mean, even just a very simple thing, to put a bit of maths on some of this. If we took the top 10% of the global population, not the other 90%, the top 10% of high emitters, these are around the globe, significant in the US and the EU and so forth, but also, you know, a significant number of people in China and India as elsewhere. But let's imagine that top 10% could reduce their emissions down to the level of the average European. Now, that's not impoverished. That's not a bad quality of life, the average European. And they could achieve that in a year. That would be a 30% reduction in global emissions. They wouldn't like it. That would mean they would have to have only one or two flights a year, and they would probably maybe only one flight a year. They'd have to start living like an average European lives.
Isn't it a lot of it from just the built-in infrastructure and way things have been designed?
Not really. I mean, the top 10% are there not because of the infrastructure. They use the same infrastructure you'd be using. When they're on the road, one person might be travelling on that road on a bus. One person might be travelling along that road on a bike. Another person might be travelling in a car that does 100 grams of carbon dioxide per kilometre, or the American car that's averaging 220 grams of carbon dioxide per kilometre. So there are huge different ways, all travelling along the road, all travelling the same 7 kilometres to pick up their groceries or whatever they're going to do. Just same road, same grocery shop at the end. People do the same things using very different levels of energy. Now, if we cannot be even bothered to say that the people responsible for 50% of global emissions can even be bothered to make that level of reduction, then, okay, let's accept the fact 3 or 4 degrees C, let's tell the poor we don't care about their futures, and we can just get on living our lives and enjoy it whilst the sun shines and let the temperatures keep going.
I heard you say in a talk that one of the primary things that people misunderstand is that it's not about targets even in, like, 2050. It's about right now, like, the next 5 years that will determine whether or not we even have a chance of getting to 2 degrees.
This comes back to this idea of about carbon budgets. For a long time, people have actually focused on these long-term targets.
Well, 80% by 2050.
80% by 2050, yeah. So that's the sort of argument they've had in the UK. We've had that enshrined in law in the UK. An 80% reduction by 2050.
You know, it feels far away.
It feels a long way away. A technology in 2030 and 2040 will solve the problem for us. The problem is there's no science to that. The science has told us very clearly we have a carbon budget. If we'd started to act a long time ago, we could have introduced more sort of gradual policies and so forth. We've squandered almost all of our carbon budget for 2 degrees centigrade, and therefore we now face these dire political repercussions that are about today. Because in 5 years from now, we'll effectively have wiped out any chance for 2 degrees centigrade. If we do not do something very significant from a policy perspective over the next few years that start to bring our emissions down, then the 2 degrees centigrade framework has basically gone. So we haven't got another 5 years to wait. Paris is the last major COP where we have any opportunity to do something on 2 degrees C. And we're not even there. We're still talking about a very thin probability now. So the reason it shifted from an 80% reduction by 2050 to actually these carbon budgets is that the carbon budgets are the scientific way to think about temperature. This way of delaying action until some technology will solve the problem in 2050, that means the carbon dioxide emissions keep rising in the atmosphere. And that's all that matters for climate change, you know, the level of CO2 in the atmosphere. So whether we keep pumping CO2 in the atmosphere and make some big reductions in 2030 or 2040 or 2050, too late. The carbon dioxide is there, changing the atmosphere, changing the climate for the next 100 to 10,000 years. And because we've left it so late, we have this very small carbon budget now, and that's why it comes, you know, it's incumbent on the current generation to do something about it in the next few years.
That was part one of an hour-long conversation between Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, and Kevin Kainers. Kainers blogs under The Elephant from Berlin, Germany. They met up in the hallway of one of the conference centers at the International Climate Summit, COP21, in Paris in December 2015. Come back for part two when TUC Radio returns. Thanks to Kevin Kainers for allowing me to rebroadcast his extraordinary interview.
This is The Soapbox, and we've been speaking to David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David, this is a very well-researched book. How long did it take you to research it and write it?
Well, the actual research and writing of this book was about 3 years, and I worked with a colleague named Karen Croft, who's a wonderful associate who has worked on all of my books with me, and so, of course, that made it go quicker. She's a wonderful researcher, but it really flowed out of my earlier book on the Kennedy brothers.
Right.
Brothers, and so when you put those two books together, they're kind of like Godfather 1 and 2. That whole project took about 6 or 7 years of our lives.
Mm. When you were researching the books, did anything surprise you, or were you pretty much knew everything, or, you know, just like, well, this is the Dulles brothers, this is Alan Dulles, so of course these things happened?
You know, I think what surprised me the most, Cindy, was his psychopathology. I didn't realize before I began really to get into the book how, you know, deeply twisted, you know, to put it bluntly, this man was, and how someone who was this pathological could rise to the very top of American power. And in fact, I think his pathology helped him do that. You know, we all know about the studies of men in power and how they often are on this spectrum of pathology, psychopathology, and certainly Alan Dulles was a man at one end of that extreme. He was able, as we talked about earlier, to do the most cruel things with really without blinking. You never got a sense from reading his writing or the interviews with him or talking to people who knew him that this was a man with any moral qualms whatsoever about all of the mayhem and bloodshed that he was responsible for. He had absolute certainty in what he was doing, and he thought that anything he did in the service of his own interests and those of the powerful men he served was justified. And so this kind of arrogance and cold cruelty, I think, has become now embedded really in the kind of the power psyche of America. And we see this through line, not just with Dulles, but all the way up to, you know, Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and John Brennan, head of the CIA today, and really, you know, despite his many attributes and his charms, you know, even the President of the United States, both Bush and Obama, were able to do really the most unspeakable things without seemingly having any kind of attacks of conscience.
Well, of course, this the United States was founded on evil genocide and slavery. But how much do you think Alan Dulles was a product of it or has influenced where we are today, that what you were just talking about, the pathology of the U.S. government?
Well, he was, I think, took it to a whole new level. America was emerging along with his own career at the same time as the most powerful nation by far in the world. Coming out of World War II, of course, most of the developed economies in Europe and Russia had been devastated by the war, and America stood alone as a robust country that had suffered actually relatively very little from this devastating war. And so that's really when the American empire goes into warp speed. Of course, the American empire has roots earlier in the century, and we know about the history of the Spanish-American War and how we stole the Philippines and Cuba and so on, and that's the beginning of the modern American empire. But after World War II, because of the power vacuum internationally, America was really able to do whatever it wanted. And the Dulles brothers, their rise to power is synonymous with that kind of new American hubris, that new American imperial hubris. And so the Dulles brothers, you can't separate their own careers from that of the rise of this enormously powerful new empire.
Well, and you think about it, the CIA is a relatively a young institution in the United States, and it's just become so powerful, so insidious since it began.
Yeah, again, it's this arrogance that, you know, as Dulles said, he had, you know, all these studies that were done during the Eisenhower era of the CIA that came out of some genuine concern about the CIA being out of control. But in the end, these studies basically reaffirmed his right to do whatever he wanted because, as one report said, in this new ruthless world that we live in, you know, facing this this, you know, ruthless rival in Moscow, the Soviet Union, anything should be permitted. Well, that's the same kind of, I think, lawlessness and immoral behavior that's been sanctioned in this country throughout the Cold War and now the War on Terror. You know, people in power in America always find a rationale for their evil, and there's no other way of putting it. When you're talking about torture and assassinations and mind control experimentation and all the rest, all the other things that the CIA has been doing for the last 50 years or more, since 1947. What is it? I'm doing the math here. 70
yeah.
years. So in any case, but that, again, that the roots of that arrogance and for American people to really understand how we got to this dark place that we're in today, they really should read The Devil's Chessboard. And I'm not just tooting my own horn here. It's just, I think it really lays out this history in a much more gripping and enlightening way than most books on this period. And the seeds of much of what is bedeviling our country now really can be found in the Devil's Chessboard era of Alan Dulles.
In your opinion, as somebody who has done all this research and has written an incredible book, and I agree, everybody should read it, do you think the CIA is stoppable? Do you think it should be stopped?
I think John Kennedy was on the right track after the Bay of Pigs disaster,
mm-hmm.
the invasion of Cuba that the CIA botched in 1961, soon after JFK took office at the White House. And he realized the CIA was out of control. That was the final straw for him. I think he came into the White House knowing because his father, Joe Kennedy, sat on the Intelligence Advisory Board And he was telling his son how to have control. The CIA was from the beginning under Alan Dulles. He made, a calculated, politically calculated, and very tragic decision, JFK, to keep Alan Dulles on board with the CIA. I think he felt because he had won such a narrow election in 1960 that he needed to keep some of these Republican establishment figures inside his administration for the sake of continuity and so on. But he realized soon what a mistake that was, and he did end up firing Dulles within the first year after the Bay of Pigs. And after that disaster, he actually asked Arthur Schlesinger, who was one of his liberal advisors, the historian from Harvard, who served Kennedy as an advisor in the White House, and he had an intelligence background himself, Schlesinger, going back to World War II with the OSS, the agency that predated the CIA. And so he asked Schlesinger, this is Kennedy, to do a review of the CIA and make a proposal to the president for how it should be reformed or broken up. Because he was so furious right after the Bay of Pigs, he famously said he wanted to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter to the winds. This was Kennedy. So essentially, Schlesinger presents a proposal to the president that follows along those lines and saying, yes, the CIA should be broken up and should be put under much firmer control. And particularly the covert action wing of the CIA is particularly problematic, Schlesinger realized, and needed much more oversight because it was essentially operating completely on its own, and Dulles was doing whatever he wanted to. So unfortunately, you know, the pushback from the CIA and the National Security State in Washington was so strong that Kennedy did not follow through on his intention to seriously reform the CIA. And it was kind of stalemated at that point. He made another error by bringing in another Republican to replace Dulles, a guy named John McCone, who was a Republican businessman, a wealthy guy from Southern California who served in the Eisenhower administration as the head of the Atomic Energy Commission. Again, another sort of national security corporate type who Kennedy thought he needed for political reasons to sort of cover that flank. But Arthur Schlesinger and others were outraged that Kennedy made that decision. They wanted someone who really was dedicated to reforming the CIA. And McCone turned out to be another traitor towards the Kennedys. He was heard going around Washington disparaging Kennedy policies all over the place at parties and so on. He was an enemy of the Kennedys. And he was an ally. He became an ally of Alan Dulles. And I believe, as I lay out in the book, that in fact, McCone was nothing more than really a figurehead. He was not an old boy from the old boy CIA network. He didn't have all the sort of inside connections that Alan Dulles did. And Alan Dulles pretty much continued to run the CIA, even though McCone was at least officially the new CIA director. And as I write in the book, all the top CIA lieutenants and officials kept coming to Dulles' home after he was fired in Georgetown, and essentially reporting to him. So this is our democracy. You know, the national security state pretty much does whatever it wants to do, no matter who's president and no matter what the president is ordering them to do.
Right. This is a little bit off topic, but it occurred to me, and I don't want to put you on the spot if you haven't seen this movie, but in the first part of the interview, we talked about Hollywood and its connections to the national security state. But did you ever see that movie, The Good Shepherd, with Matt Damon?
I did.
And how do you think, this is just kind of an aside, do you think that that was based loosely on Alan Dulles' life?
I do. I think it was based on the Dulles era, and there was kind of composite characters based on Dulles and on James Jesus Angleton, of course, is notorious sidekick, the head of counterintelligence. You know, I think the movie was directed by Robert De Niro, was well-meaning, but I think it was confused, and the history was kind of a mashup of lots of things. I think the great movie about the real CIA has yet to be made.
Uh-huh.
We talked earlier, as you said, Cindy, about the difficulty of getting Hollywood to make truthful movies about the national security state. You know, after Oliver Stone made the explosive film, JFK, probably one of the most honest films ever made about American power, back in 1991, the CIA essentially said, well, that's not going to happen again. And they set up a major office, which continues to operate to this day in Hollywood, to review films about, you know, the espionage world, about national security, and to basically spin Hollywood the way they want Hollywood to go. So as a result, I think ever since that era, you've seen, you know, kind of one movie after the next or TV show that glorifies the national security state, that says what we need is actually more aggressive action against the bad guys, not more congressional or democratic oversight. And, you know, always in these films or TV shows, the people who are trying to control the CIA and prevent them from doing all this, whatever they want to do, are portrayed as kind of wimpy bureaucrats who are standing in the way of protecting the American people. And so you have, you know, shows like Homeland, you know, Zero, movies like Zero Dark Thirty,
24.
Yeah, 24, American Sniper. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that. If you look at who's making these TV shows and films, you see that in many cases, they're actually, the producers or writers are actually employed by the CIA at one point. They were CIA agents. And if not that, then the people who are advising these producers and writers are often CIA people or former CIA people. So there's a propaganda machine, a CIA propaganda machine that is very active in Hollywood. In fact, my new book imprint, Hot Books, is publishing a new book in June called Spooked by a great young investigative journalist, Nicholas Scow, who wrote the book Kill the Messenger about Gary Webb.
Oh, yeah.
And the movie starring Jeremy Renner was based on that, a movie that no one saw because the studio dumped it.
Right.
And to the CIA's great delight. But you should, you know, download it on Netflix and watch that movie. It's a great movie, and it shows how the CIA manipulates the press. And in the case of Gary Webb, drove this heroic investigative journalist not only out of the profession, but to his death. He ended up, of course, committing suicide. So, in any case, it's very difficult because the CIA roadblocks and their influence in Hollywood to get an honest movie made about things like I write about. And I had a very, you know, unfortunate episode already. We talked about this a little before, I think, in your experience in Hollywood. But with my earlier book, Brothers, which was optioned by Lionsgate, this is my book about Bobby Kennedy and his search for the truth about what happened to his brother in Dallas. And it was optioned by Lionsgate. We had all these big names attached to do the TV series based on the book. And it looked like one place after the next. It was ready to go. And then at the last minute, including you know, Stars Network, which is run by supposedly this very brave guy, Chris Albrecht, who did Sopranos at HBO. Chris Albrecht loved it. He was all set to go to make Brothers the centerpiece of his fall season. And then, like, 2 days later, suddenly we get a call, sorry, it's off. So, you know, he never explained why, but you can only imagine. You know, did he get a call from someone saying, what, are you crazy? You can't do this series. You know, it says that Bobby Kennedy believed his brother was killed by the CIA. So I think there's enormous pressures on Hollywood people to toe the company line, the company being the CIA or the Pentagon or you know, whatever. And it's really unfortunate because most people get their information, you know, from entertainment in this country, from Hollywood. And if it's not on the big screen or the little screen, you know, it's kind of invisible. Books, you know, like mine, the ones that we write, people like us, Cindy, they get to a certain audience. But, you know, right. My book, for instance, this new book that I just wrote, I've now heard, despite the media blackout, The Devil's Chessboard has sold about 40,000 copies in hardback and ebook.
Nice.
Well, that's not bad, and it'll probably get up to, you know, higher than that by the time the paperback comes out. But say between the hardback and the paperback and the ebooks, it sells ultimately over 100,000 copies. In the book world, that will be seen as a solid success. But, you know, when you're talking about trying to influence a country of, what, 200 and what, 80 million people?
330
about
this point.
Is it now?
Yeah.
I'm behind the curve.
Yeah.
In any case, you know, your impact is pretty limited as a writer. And the only way that you can make a wider impact is if Hollywood, if the film world, the entertainment world does you know, make something based on your book. And even then, of course, you're not certain it'll have any impact because, like this great movie Kill the Messenger by Gary Webb, completely disappeared. And I bet there's not more than, you know, at the most, but a couple hundred thousand people who even knew that movie existed. So anyway, it's a battle, you know. Writing is fighting, as Ishmael Reed, the writer, once said. And I'm not naive about this, but, you know, we all have to be prepared. We're in a long-term battle to take this country back from the oligarchy, the permanent war state, the Wall Street war state, as I call it, that took this country over. And it took it over under Alan Dulles and his brother. And they've been occupying our country ever since, these forces of greed and violence. And it's up to the people, people like us, to reclaim our country.
I do want to talk about your publishing concern and American Nuremberg. The thing that I thought about The Good Shepherd when I saw it with my sister, is we wanted to, after it was over, we wanted to like make everybody in the audience stay and have a teach-in about how this wasn't fiction. It was, you know, the CIA is evil and actually does things like this. But to us, the danger was that people just thought it was a fictional story, like zombies or vampires or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think people, in, by and large, are, when it comes to spies, they just think James Bond, or right. They think, you know, Mission Impossible. And it, to them, it's a cool world. It's a world where, you know, these warriors, these knights are out there defending our lives. And we kind of feel like, well, do whatever you have to do to protect us, right. You know, our peace and our security. And unfortunately, that kind of ignorance leads America into one kind of disaster after the next. The only way for the American people to, you know, I think, change the course of this country is to start growing up, not acting like children, mm-hmm. not seeing this as all a fairy tale. You know, the good guys versus bad guys, and we're always the good guys, that the world is much more complex and disturbing than that, and they have to read books, and they have to educate themselves. And the media doesn't make it, you know, easy, because yeah. the media is just so filled with lies and propaganda, that there are ways to sift through all that bullshit and to get to the truth, but it takes some energy and it takes some commitment.
All right, David. Well, thank you so much. I know you're really busy and you've given the Soapbox so much of your time, and we really appreciate it. Like I said, for part one, we got some great feedback. But let's talk about this new project, American Nuremberg and Hot Books, is it?
Yeah, so I have taken a little break from writing. And in the last year or so, I've partnered with Skyhorse, which is a wonderful independent book publisher. They've done some terrific books on national security and on, you know, all the issues we've been talking about, books by Jesse Ventura, John Kiriakou, the CIA whistleblower, uh-huh. and many others. And this new series is called Hot Books. It's a series of short investigative books on the most burning topics in America. And so our most recent release is American Nuremberg by a philosophy professor at the University of San Francisco, which is the Catholic University here in San Francisco. Her name is Rebecca Gordon. She also was a human rights activist in Central America during the Reagan Wars there. She's a brave and very brilliant woman. And she's written a book called American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Be Indicted for War Crimes Post 9/11. And, you know, from Obama and Bush on down, it's a very thoughtful, it's not just, you know, rant. It's a very thoughtful legal and philosophical discourse on the crimes that have been committed in our names by these men, and the stain that's left on our country, and how we as citizens can do the job that Congress should be doing and right. courts, but won't. And that's bringing these men somehow to justice, and at least starting the process that, say, Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre did during the Vietnam War, with a citizen's inquiry into the war crimes. And so that's what she ends up calling for. And as I say, we have another really terrific book by Nick Scow coming out on the CIA and how it manipulates the press and Hollywood. It's called Spooked, and that'll be out in June. And then The Burn Pits is another recent book by a military whistleblower named Joseph Hickman, who served in the Marines and the Army. And Joe writes about these terrible open-air pits where the Army has been burning everything imaginable at military bases in Afghanistan and Iraq, everything from plastics to tires to old WMD to medical waste, human body parts. And so this terrible pollution has sickened thousands of our soldiers and also people who live in those areas. And many of these soldiers are not coming home with terrible respiratory diseases, right, and their cancers, including, we believe, Bo Biden, who served at one of the most polluted bases.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he, of course, died right. from a rare brain cancer. He was right. perfectly healthy before he went overseas. So, again, these books are being blacked out. They're being ignored. The media hasn't been paying attention. It's the same treatment that I got with my own book. But we're doing our best to turn these books into a cause, because they are important books for the American people to know and discuss. And we're doing our best.
Well, keep in touch with me, and anything that I can do or the Cindy Sheehan Soapbox can do, get these authors on, you know, to help promote the books, just let me know, and we'll be happy to help with these things, especially with American Nuremberg, because, you know, it'll be my goal, my mission till the day I die, to get justice for Casey and for millions of other people.
Well, I'm so honored to be on your show, Cindy, and I respect so much what you've done for not just your own family and the memory of Casey, but for the American people over the years. And, you know, carry on. And I would love to continue working with you in any way I can.
Oh, perfect. Me too. So, David, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think we've done a great job covering it.
Oh, thank you so much again for giving your time and for everything you do.